You're listening to the Hollywood Saloon.
What you got in your hand?
Pearl Harbor 4 disc edition.
Yeah, you getting it?
I don't know, man. I got the 2 disc at home.
Let me see that. Wow, dude. 3 audio commentaries with the filmmakers. Look, animatic scene concepts from director Michael Bay? Are you kidding me?
Like I said, dude, I got the 2 disc already.
Take my advice, my friend. Double dip on the Pearl Harbor.
Think?
Oh, yeah. Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Here we go. Another episode of a couple of white guys sitting around talking.
Hello, this is Terry Gilliam.
This is Steven Soderbergh.
Hi, everybody. This is Jim Cameron.
I'm Arnold Schwarzenegger.
And I'm John Milius the Great.
Hi, I'm Kevin Reynolds.
Hi, this is Joel Schumacher.
I'm Nicholas Meyer.
Hi, I'm Ridley Scott.
Hi, this is Michael Bay.
Hello, welcome to Audio Track 16B. The character you're about to see,
you sort of see a trailer of the character you're about to see for the rest of the film.
Very much
my
so.
Great
I try to stay.
Break was nobody ever told me what was not possible.
Actual release of the picture.
And they run up to the top of those steps, and they get
so
there.
I
and
was trying to root the movie in some kind of reality that I could
relate to. The joke was on me about 10 days before when the first wardrobe guy showed me what he had to offer.
A lot of dust in there. It was hard to get this airport in the Philippines, in Manila, outside Manila.
In Batman and Robin,
you also get the planes. You didn't have a lot of money to make the movie. Less
desire
about $6 million.
To keep it more family friendly, more kid
friendly. You know, at one point, I said I was going to shoot this film like a Sergio Leone Western, only in New York, in the city.
And I said, you know, I've been in a lot of movies.
Here's
where
the making of the sword. This whole movie has to do with that.
Oh, you and Tangerine Dream. Oh, boy.
It's, well, I'll say in your defense and in mine that screenwriting is it's a hopeless profession. And my God, if Robert Towne can complain about Chinatown to this day,
he's a real god. But that's a dope word.
What do you want?
That's a character in the movie.
We're rolling now, Saul.
Welcome, Hollywood Salooners. My name is Andy, and across the country from me is Mr. John Jansen.
Hello, welcome all.
That's right, welcome all. And we're going to dive into a subject that has fascinated us for a long time. One of our hobbies, one of our most favorite things in the world to do, is when you buy those shiny new DVDs, crack open that case. Sure, you're going to watch the movie. We love the movies we buy, but what's the next coolest thing? How about that commentary?
That's right.
Get that nice new commentary track by the director you want.
Exactly.
Multiple commentary tracks sometimes. It's really just a treasure chest. I mean, sometimes you open up those DVDs and it's just a virtual treasure chest of goodness coming out of there. And so we're going to talk about that today. So let's just see where this takes us.
Well, it's interesting because I was wondering, should we open up the show by defining what a commentary track is? And I'm thinking most people nowadays in 2007 are very familiar with the commentary track. Obviously, it goes back to Laserdisc.
Sure.
And I don't know if you know this, but a bit of trivia, the very, very first commentary track is, well, I mean, it's almost like we should have a special theme song for these guys, the Criterion.
Yeah. You know, superheroes, but, superhero song.
they almost deserve their own theme for their contributions to film history, film preservation, and film education, most importantly. 'Cause in a lot of ways, these commentary tracks, I mean, they were first thought of. The first one was for Criterion's King Kong. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, it was a film historian by the name of Ronald Haver. And he opened up the commentary with this. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Ronald Haver. And I'm here to do something which we feel is rather unique. I'm going to take you on a lecture tour of King Kong as you watch the film. The Laserdisc technology offers us this opportunity, and we feel it's rather unique. The ability to switch back and forth between the soundtrack and this lecture track. So basically, this is the first introduction of taking the idea of having that second audio track, which was on the Laserdiscs, and they didn't ever fill it with an extra audio language most of the time on domestic Laserdiscs. But they had this extra space to put this commentary track or this extra sometimes they could isolate the music score with it as well, which is also a popular feature of Laserdiscs. So here you have a historian going over screen-specific commentary, something that you might get in the classroom if you were taking a class on King Kong. Now you had in the comfort of your own home. So there you have it. The commentary track was born.
Yeah, we'll see. And I think that's absolutely fascinating because, I mean, really, it's become a pretty regular thing in our lives now. It's not anything shocking when we get buy a disc. Sometimes you don't even realize it. You know you're going to buy a movie and you don't even recognize it. But yet, really, I just think we're kind of all spoiled because we do have it now. When you think back to those days when it was just beginning, and for people like, you know, film historians, people who really dig into movies, who like to get down in there deep like you and I do, I mean, what could be more incredible than hearing a director, a producer, a writer, you know, and different crew members, even actors, talk about their experience in making the film. I mean, I'm a big fan of behind-the-scene documentaries, obviously, but there's something special about a commentary. And, you know, it has to do with, you know, is it screen-specific? Is it just a basic running idea? But, I mean, seriously.
At least you know you're going to get something that runs the length of the film.
Right.
That was my first thing.
Exactly.
Is, wow, he's going to talk over the entire length of the film. That's like getting a two-hour interview of the director. You know, or
well,
two and a half, depending on the.
That's
the
thing.
Of the film.
That's the thing that's really special is that that's a very uncommon thing. I mean, when are you going to find a two and a half hour, you know, interview or conversation with Francis Coppola or something like that, or Lucas about, you know, a specific Star Wars film, or James Cameron about Terminator 2? I mean, on and on and on. You know, we can go talking about this, but I think that it's just to me. I still am in awe of the commentary track, really. I haven't let it sink in. I'm trying not to forget it. And the thing that blows me away sometimes is when I look at my DVD collection, I realize just how many commentary tracks I haven't really dug into yet. I mean, I could probably spend years rewatching my movies with just the commentary tracks, you know. And so I think that it's just something that's such a magical, wonderful, incredible thing that really, you know, we have to thank Criterion for really bringing this to fruition, even though, like I said, you know, you see it these days being overused, not used correctly. I mean,
and
I guess
we can get into those examples a little bit later.
Sure.
When we talk about the different categories. But I think you bring up a good point: is when is the appropriate time to listen to a commentary track?
Right.
It's not like you're sitting around with your friends saying, "Hey, let's throw on that commentary track."
Right.
Often, I find that my greatest impulse to hear a commentary track is either for a film that I've seen many times, and I buy the DVD and it has the commentary on it.
Right.
And that can often be the very first thing I go to listen to.
Right.
Because that's the thing I'm most interested in, is hearing that director speak over it. Like when the Apocalypse Now came out.
Right.
That was the first thing I went to, was the commentary track. Because that's what interested me the most. I mean, I knew the film pretty well.
Sure.
So I knew I'd get around to watching it again later. But, you know, hearing a running commentary over the entire length. And I had known Coppola's previous commentaries, which had always been superior. I mean, I certainly remember seeing these expensive box sets when I would go to, you know, the record store, the video stores, and I would always, you know, thumb through the Laserdisc section before I got my player.
Right.
Kind of, because I was very interested in the whole letterboxing thing. Mm-hmm. And I start seeing these box sets, and these weren't cheap. These are $124
right.
and so forth.
Right.
And I remember seeing, you know, like the Citizen Kane and the Raging Bull and the Taxi Driver. But the first one I ever got was the Fisher King.
Hello, this is Terry Gilliam speaking. I had three rules in my life when it came to making films. One, I would never do anybody else's script but my own. Number two, I would never work for a major motion picture studio. And number three, I would never work in America. I've done all three of these things, and it's called The Fisher King.
And it was Terry Gilliam's commentary that completely turned me on to the format.
I find there are these dangerous mirrors that are holding up the world to us, the radio, the television, the cinema, and the videos. And I come from television. I know the power of the medium, and it scares me, and I find it's misused too often. I find films are misused too often. I think it probably informs the 20th century more than any other technology. And so we're the beneficiaries, we're the victims of it. It's a dangerous, dangerous animal that has to be dealt with. And in a sense, his film uses that as its stepping-off point. I always like to have something that's extremely dangerous in everything I do, and this film was slowly forming itself into something that was very safe and easy. When you read the script, the first impression you have is not Jeff Bridges. It's a sleek New York, fast-talking character. Jeff is almost the opposite. I think Jeff is middle America. He's from the heartland. Because I like the idea, if it could work, I thought, this can be fantastic. Because then it elevates the film again to a slightly larger film than just New York. It becomes a bit more mythic. It becomes more about America. If you can take somebody from the heartland of America and he comes to New York, he makes his way in the big city, he becomes more cynical, more sarcastic. He loses more of his humanity along the way than somebody who was born like that. I mean, it's one thing for a New Yorker who was born tough and hard, and it's another thing for a guy coming from the heart of America who has to give up his soul, in a sense, to become this other character. And I thought that would make the fall that much greater. So when he falls and he has to redeem himself, the climbing back is much more epic. Once I decided to try to see New York through Perry's eyes, things started happening, and one of the things that started happening was the discovery of this particular building in New York, because there it is. What excites me about this shot is that it's clear. It's in the city. It's not faked. It's not painted. And I said, wow, a medieval castle in the middle of New York. And I jokingly said, that's where the Grail ought to be. And then I immediately dismissed that, saying, no, we're not going that direction. The brief I gave myself was to try to not make a fantastical film, not to do my normal abstracting, distorting, twisting, grotesquing of the real world or my versions of the world. And I failed miserably at this attempt. Everybody insisted we go that direction. And so we developed a kind of a battle between us where I would insist on things being more ordinary and they would say, no, come on. Come on, this is better. Roger Pratt, the cameraman, when he looked at the stills, he said, you got to do it, Terry, come on. And so I found I was being pushed forward into making the kinds of films I always make by the people who I hired to do just the opposite. Want to look at things. Before she picks up her glass, its shadow is on the wall and it looks like the Holy Grail. We don't fuck around. The symbols are there everywhere.
And what was fascinating is, I mean, I was already a fan of The Fisher King, but it was almost as if I went into a lecture with Gilliam, and it's like, Gilliam was your teacher that day. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, class, today we're going to watch my film, and I'm just going to talk about how I did it, and what was on my mind, and the stories. And it was, in that 2-hour, 135-minute running time of the film, it was better than almost any film class I had taken. Learning things that you never would have thought to consider that goes into, you know, the making of a film that you can only get from a very creative person like Gilliam, but also someone that was involved in so many aspects of the film. But I was completely hooked, and I thought this would be a good way to carry on my postgraduate film studies, is this whole commentary track idea. Because the next two I got were Raging Bull and Taxi Driver.
Well, Palantine at that time was sort of like we were hoping, again, going back to the tragedy of the road the country took and the assassinations from November 63 on, was the loss of all the great, potentially great leaders, because they had the promise, you know? But he couldn't care less if he was liberal or conservative. Travis couldn't care less. No, he had to do something to make himself, to make his force, power known, you know? And he had to try to change things, even if it was with a political candidate he had no interest in, really. And the fact that he couldn't kill the candidate or wound him or maim him, whatever, he just, on second thought, I think I'll go kill Sport and the guy who takes care of the whorehouse and kill as many people as possible, then I'll kill myself. But as you can see, he has no bullets left. That was his screw-up. Frank Warner is the man who supervised, who actually did the sound effects in this film. We really had a good time working together with him later on in Raging Bull, where he, I think he did such a wonderful job of sound effects and sound effects cutting and the use of each punch, for example, in Raging Bull was a different sound. It was either an orange being crushed or a watermelon being punched or I don't know what. I mean, And finally, for example, each flashbulb going off with different sounds, rifle shots, cymbals, garbage pail covers slammed together. And I remember people wanted to know what he used specifically where, but I believe he always answered that he burned his special effects afterwards, sound effects, because he didn't want anybody else using them.
Evoking impassioned responses, this bloodbath divided viewers as to the necessity of the extreme graphic violence. Director Michael Powell wrote, "I've heard people whine about the violence in Mean Streets, the violence in Taxi Driver. Scorsese is an artist. Pick up a copy of Disasters of War. See that naked, maimed figure of a man impaled on a stake? See those tumbled women raped and murdered? See that priest hanged from a tree? Do you think that Goya was trying to get a cheap thrill out of these horrors? No more is Martin Scorsese. He has an eye that misses nothing, that looks on beauty and terror with the same dispassionate eye, with the same love and compassion. He cannot tell anything but the truth."
There's no such thing as a guy like this staying calm for too long. You know, especially that look and those eyes. Again, from the Michael Powell influence. If you look at all the moves of Robert Altman in Tales of Hoffman, you'll see those angles, that feeling. I hope you'll see it. Maybe I see it. Maybe nobody else sees it. I don't know, but it winds up here. What can I say?
Getting the Scorsese was like getting your film history professor teacher. And he's already your favorite director. So now you get him talking over two of your favorite films.
Yeah.
And suddenly the whole world was open. And Criterion's influence was enormous, because suddenly other commentaries started popping up on just regular Laserdiscs.
I mean, really, if you were just wanting a film education and wanted to dive in, you could, you know, through the mass, you know, sheer number of commentaries out there, you could really give yourself a pretty quality education if you just sat down and studied these things. I mean, you know, back when I was in film school, you know, at one point we had Rick Linklater show up, and he gave us a lecture. We watched Slacker, and then we talked about it a lot afterwards. We asked him questions, hung out with him, and all that kind of stuff. Now, fast forward to today, you're sitting at home. If you want a commentary by Linklater or someone else, boom, you buy their disc, and you got the same thing, basically. Yeah, it's not one-on-one. You don't get to shake their hand, et cetera, et cetera. But I think the basic idea is there. And if they are a focused person that wants to get as much information as they possibly can into that commentary, boy, I mean, that's better than even having a one-on-one session, because they're not being pulled from here to there. They're very focused and they're going after it. And I think really, as a tool of education for people who are into this and wanting to learn to be filmmakers, or just wanting to understand the creation process, I mean, there really is no better tool, you know, especially when you're talking, you know, screen-specific type stuff. Like, okay, here's this scene, and here's how I set it up, and here's the idea I was going for.
Well, it certainly plays into the library concept of what films have become and what DVDs have turned them into. Mm-hmm. It's more than just the movie. It's the movie, and it's all of the production, the trailers, the marketing, the posters, mm-hmm. and we have a commentary track talking over it. It's a complete package that goes on a shelf that preserves the making of that thing.
Right.
You know, literally forever. And obviously, not all DVDs are created equal, and sure, some are better than others. But what I think is fascinating about this is there's a lot of different types, a variety of commentaries, and I didn't even mention one, the screen-specific one.
Mm-hmm.
But everything that we're talking about wouldn't appeal to someone like my mother.
Right, right.
Who could care less about all that. However, I remember when we watched The Hours, mm-hmm. there was a commentary track with Nicole Kidman, Meryl Streep, and Julianne Moore. Now, that did interest her, because she loves all three of those actresses. That's why she wanted to see the film in the first place.
Right.
So as soon as she watches the film, this is when I was teaching her what DVDs were all about. I said, look at this. Now you can flip over, and now you have the film all over again, but you're going to hear these three actresses talk about their experiences making it.
Right.
She thought that was the coolest thing.
Yeah.
Something that she never would have considered. Now, she couldn't care less about the director or the editor or the camera or anything like that.
Right.
But the actresses, something that she was certainly interested in, that appealed to her. And I think, again, it opens up the format of the commentary tracks. I mean, there's been some really awesome sets that have made sure to include not one, not two, but sometimes up to four commentary tracks.
Right.
Basically getting all the quadrants of the making of the film and the perspective. Because You've got to ask the first question. Why are we recording a commentary track? Well, I think you answered it earlier, so you have to have one today, right? It's an added, considered an added value to the disc, so they throw one on there regardless, right?
Right. Well, if you go to buy a DVD and you look at the back and, you know, they've got to display those special features, it's pretty common now. If you don't have it, it's kind of like, ooh, there's a big gap missing here. There's like, okay, I know I'm going to get some enjoyment out of this disc, but I'm not going to get full enjoyment out of this disc. I know that when I go to pick up a disc, and if I'm iffy on it, and it does have a commentary track, that very much plays in its favor as opposed to not getting it. That's like buying a music CD and there's three tracks missing. You know, they say, oh, sorry, there's, you know, you can't get these three tracks on CD. You have to get it on something else. And I pulled a Jansenism there.
They have the screen specific, obviously, mm-hmm. to where they're just commenting exactly what's on the screen.
Right.
But if it's not an engaging speaker, it just turns into a running commentary of what you're looking at.
Right.
And that's not very good.
No.
Exactly. That's right. Isn't it? I see the camel.
Yeah, that's coming up.
Yeah.
You know, because not all commentary tracks are equal. One thing that I think Criterion really perfected was a type of either interview process to where certain questions were fed or either prepared to where there was always something to go to speak on specifically. Mm-hmm. It's really helpful when you have a director's engaging of someone like Martin Scorsese or Terry Gilliam, who just love to talk.
Right.
And there's never a boring spot in any of those. I mean, if you get like 2 or 3 seconds of silence, you're lucky,
yeah.
you know, on some of those commentary tracks.
Right.
But then you get the others that have the long gaps of silence.
Yeah, that's the killer for me.
And, you know, you just wonder, do these people prepare? I think a lot of it is, oh, come in and do this commentary track. It's this new thing. And, you know, they come in early in the morning, they have a cup of coffee, they sit down, they run the film. They probably haven't seen the film since they made the film.
Right.
If it's a really older film. And they're expected to suddenly come up and comment on it. Mm-hmm. And that's not an easy thing to do. And we'll go into a little bit later in the show why you and I know how difficult trying to cover a film on a commentary can be.
Right, exactly.
But I think there is an art form to it. Some are much better edited and put together as a package. Mm-hmm. I think it's almost like you're editing a podcast. You got a lot of things to consider. You want to keep a flow going, but mostly you want to use all the best material. I mean, just because the director talks for 2 hours over the whole thing doesn't mean it was all interesting and good.
Right.
You know, maybe some of the 2 or 3 other spots that weren't so engaging or there was gaps of silence, go get one of the actors and just intercut their perspective or thoughts in. So I think you get a lot of commentary tracks that take that philosophy as well.
Well, I think the cool thing is it's really just there's so many options available to you, and it really comes down to what your choice is. Now, if you're a completist and you go to like something like the big extended editions of Lord of the Rings, you know, where there's all these multiple commentaries stacked up, you've got a lot of listening to do, a whole lot of listening to do. But, you know, if you're someone who wants to soak up every little detail, then, you know, how wonderful is that, you know? But, you know, some other people might say, well, that's overkill. I don't need to see it. Well, then just don't listen to it, you know, move on. If you don't want to hear what the costume designer was thinking, you know, or something like that, well, then, you know, you can pass on that commentary track. The thing that's cool is just the fact that when you make all those things available, that's extremely exciting. Now, personally, myself, when I listen to commentaries, obviously, you know, the first thing I want to go to is I want to know what the director's thinking. That's obviously where I go, and that's really one of the first type of commentary types that we're talking about here. And the thing that gets me the most is I want to see what the creator, the driving force behind any film was thinking, his basic overviews, his ideas in the creation of the film. Sometimes screen-specific ideas, you know, you get to that particular scene that you love, that, you really want to say, okay, please, you know, break this down for me and let me hear what you were thinking when you created this.
See, it opens up sort of a passageway of different schools of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's the director that says, that's all fine and great, but I don't want you to have all that information.
Right.
The movies are magical. I don't want to do anything that brings down the curtain and exposes what we did. Mm-hmm. I don't want to break the spell for you in that kind of sense. So I'm not going to do a commentary track.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or I have no interest in. I mean, there's several directors out there. I mean, we would never have gotten a Kubrick commentary track.
Right.
The same reason why Woody Allen's not interested in doing a commentary track.
Right.
Or Steven Spielberg, for that matter, who's never done one for any of his films. M. Night hasn't done a commentary track for any of his films.
Shyamalan.
Quentin Tarantino has only done one for True Romance.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there's a lot of directors that, you know, I certainly respect and admire and would love to hear their thoughts that don't do them. Sadly, there's a lot of them that have passed away before the format came into its popular vogue.
Oh,
which
yeah,
would have been very interesting to have some of their thoughts as a historical record.
To have a Peckinpah commentary, to have a Leone commentary. I mean, how incredible would that be? I mean, go back to any directors, you know, just to hear what they have to say. As far as the guys who don't do it, you know, I completely respect their decision to not do it, because I, you know, if anything, it's true about movies is that the curtain has been pulled down and people do know how the trick is done, and a lot of time it has lost a lot of magic. You know, people just aren't as excited anymore, and it's always more and more and more that you got to ramp up to blow people away. And I think that, I mean, a great example of that is just CG in movies. Everyone is getting to the point now where they know what computer graphics is. They know how to spot it. It's no big deal to say, okay, yeah, that entire landscape is computer generated. So I think that their desire, those directors' desire not to pull back that curtain is a totally logical one, and I completely understand why they would do that. Do I like it? No. Would I love to hear their thoughts? Absolutely. And you can hear some of their thoughts in certain interviews or behind the scenes.
Spielberg participates so big in those documentaries.
Right.
And he feels like everything that he's asked and covers there is the equivalent of a commentary probably anyway.
Sure.
But for whatever reason, he just doesn't have a desire to sit down and do the screen-specific type track. And, you know, I'm like you. I can understand.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, Scorsese, probably just out of his own personal passion and obligation as a film historian himself, sees the importance and how it could be beneficial, perhaps, to other film students and filmmakers out there.
Well, and it just shows you what kind of a very different director Scorsese and Spielberg are. You know, Spielberg has always kind of been about, you know, Hollywood magic and all that. And Scorsese's always been about, you know, reality, you know, and the wanting to be the kind of director that would share that information, like, you know, here's the journey I've taken and you're welcome to come with me.
I don't think Hitchcock would have been very interesting or engaging on a commentary track, probably.
Right.
Or John Ford might have grown bored with the process.
Well, they'd just be like, forget this, let's go do another picture, you know?
Exactly. I mean, they'd rather go make a movie.
What the hell are we doing here talking about this crap? The movie's done, let's go make another picture.
Yeah. A lot of these directors, everything they had to say about the film is in the film.
Right.
A lot of them, if they could say it, they wouldn't have to make the films.
Well, a lot of times, certain films are rather ambiguous, you know. They want to leave it up to the viewer's discretion as to what happens, you know. And sometimes it's always better that way.
Now, of course, the big ambiguity here is, you know, is she alive? Or dreaming, or is she dead and on her way to Titanic heaven here? And of course, I'll never tell. I mean, I know what we intended at the time, but that doesn't mean I have to go blurting it out. So I know you've bought this, you know, expensive special edition DVD and you were, you know, hoping for the answer, but the answer has to be something that you supply personally, individually.
The commentary track, it's not to speak into the film, it's to comment on the film. So.
Right, and I think you have another sort of category that a lot of directors use the commentary track to sort of maybe clear up.
Oh, right, set the record straight.
Set the record straight, right. I know, like, The Highlander 2 is a great big apology track, but it sort of lays out the how the film was taken away by the financiers and how the... where they were shooting it, the dollar shifted, and it went spiraling out of control.
Well, see, and that's when I'm... one of my most favorite type of commentary tracks in the world is what is this one, the apology commentary or the set the record straight commentary, because I think that it's extremely fascinating when films have gone wrong and they're not still trying to, like, you know, act. They're not still trying to play. I mean, hearing Schumacher do Batman and Robin,
It's a good track,
that's
actually
a fantastic commentary. I really love it because, you know, yeah, we know the film's a dud, but why? You know, what happened in this in this giant rush to make this film, you know, just had this thing fall apart? And he's honest about it, and he says,
this particular movie, because Batman Forever had been so successful and brought a lot of people back into the theaters, there was enormous pressure on us to create more inventions in the film that could be turned into toys. I learned a new phrase in my life called toyetic, whether a movie is toyetic or not, and how many toys people can get out of it. Hence, a lot of toys in this movie.
So all of those things that you're designing, they're ripping them out of your hands because they're going to make the molds. The molds for them usually have to be made in Asia. So you have to give them the designs far in advance so they can get these molds made to make the toys made, so the toys will be out when the movie's coming out. So everything that we did was, can you make it bigger, can you make it better? And I'm not criticizing anyone. I signed on to do this. I was doing this job, but that was a major part of the job.
Yeah, I was there. I was awake. I saw it coming. I wasn't alone.
But I take responsibility.
And good for him, and I respect the hell out of him for doing that.
I do, too.
But those kind of commentary tracks are really some of my favorite because, you know, there's so many sad stories about how films were taken away or...
Well, think about Superman 2, the Richard Donner cut. That whole thing is a soapbox for Donner to complain for 116 minutes. You know?
Exactly.
Get his side out.
and that to me is, you know, like I said, we know all these horrible stories. Let's set the record straight. Let's find out what really happened. And really, it's even better when you hear the offending party. You know, everyone just, you know, whipped the shit out of Schumacher for so many years, and he really didn't get a chance to get in there and say, okay, this is what happened, guys. You know, but can you imagine the extreme pressure that was on top of him when he was trying to make this film, and everyone was just stepping all over him, and the toy manufacturers, and let's all do this. So anyways, that's a commentary I highly suggest people pick up because it's worth it hearing that thing. Like you said, The Highlander 2. Now, on the flip side of that, it's kind of sad when you see a film that you know tanked, but they go ahead and do that commentary anyways because maybe it's expected, but they still try to play it off as, you know, rah, rah, go team. This isn't really a good film still. You know, and
well, sometimes the commentaries are recorded before the film comes out.
Right.
You know, in the last few years, they're prepping for the DVD even that early. So they don't even know how the film did when they're commenting on it.
Right. So it's all still part of the promotional push to make it sound great. It's like, you know, that's the cardinal rule. Never speak against any film you're in. I mean, you know, it's Arnold. You know, remember Arnold would go on to every time he'd go on to Jay Leno or David Letterman, he'd be like, this is the best movie I've ever made.
That's right. Exactly.
You know, it's like, no, it's not. It's not the best movie you've ever made. It's one of the worst movies you've ever made, Arnold. No, but trust me, this is the best one. And, you know, I mean, he's a master of marketing. You know, you don't ever talk down anything you've done. But when you hear those commentaries, that's a real disappointment. When you know the film is bad and these guys are still spinning, you know, they're still in spin mode. They want to look good for the suits. Or sometimes they'll go as far as not including the director. It's like, oh, here's a commentary from the producer. But we don't want to hear what's the guy from League of Extraordinary Gentlemen?
Oh, Stephen Norrington. Yeah.
Yeah, we don't want to hear what Stephen Norrington said. We knew after the fact that he had said, you know, I never want to work in Hollywood again. After he made League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. But it's kind of like, is he on that commentary? Nowhere to be found. Yeah. You know, same with David Fincher on Alien 3. He just said, you know, I'll pass. No thanks. Because you know that he couldn't get in there and really dig deep and dig his claws in there.
If he's going to talk, he's going to be honest. And some people won't be happy with what he has to say.
Right. And to me, that's the best kind of commentary I want to hear. Is, you know, not that I want to hear commentary tracks to bad films. But, you know, if there was conflict, yeah, I'd like to hear the story of how it came together and how films were wrenched away. I mean, God, what I wouldn't pay to hear the trials and tribulations of poor Sam Peckinpah and how all his films were ripped. Now, you know, so that's a shame. But, you know, I think of a commentary track that I would die to hear more on is when Shatner directed Star Trek V: The Final Frontier. Yet the commentary track that he did was very calm. It was very together. And he, you know, the real story is it wasn't just that Shatner sucked. It's that Shatner got ripped off. You know, it's like they had just made the biggest Star Trek movie when they made Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home. And yet they penny pinched his ass when they were doing The Final Frontier. Now, granted, they didn't necessarily believe in the story.
Well, and I think they were getting Planet of the Apes syndrome, that law of diminishing returns.
Right.
You know, they were thinking, right. Well, we just grossed the highest with four.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think five's going to outgross four, so let's spend this money on it.
They were iffy on the whole project because they knew that they had let Nimoy direct two. They got to let Shatner in there, or he's going to walk, you know? I mean, and he had directed before. He's a competent director. He directed television and whatnot. You know, Nimoy didn't have any chops before he stepped into the director's chair. So they knew they had to do it, and they went ahead and did it. It's just that, you know, maybe if he would have picked a different story, it might have worked out better. But, you know, there's a big arduous tale. I read his book, and so there's much more there about what really happened on that film. Yet, in the commentary, he's kind of playing it safe, and he's not getting too dirty. Because, you know, I'm sure he doesn't want to sully his relationship with Paramount, because there was always more. I mean, gosh, after five, he was in, what, at least two more Trek movies?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I mean, I think that was okay. But, yeah, those commentaries are fascinating to me. I would love to hear more of those get down in the dirt and let's be honest about this thing commentaries.
Well, then I think you'd probably find what was quite revealing is when Spinal Tap got a chance to comment on the movie made about them. For the MGM release of This is Spinal Tap, the band members were allowed to come in and set the record straight. On the hatchet job that Marty DeBurgi had made of their tour.
When I heard that Tap was releasing a new album,
we hate that when you used to call us Tap.
Tap,
yeah. It's Spinal Tap. Could be anything. It could be, you know, Denver Tap
or beer.
Beer Tap.
Beer Tap.
Right.
I don't even think of beer.
No, and look at the guitar. Look at the bass. It's a Fender bass. You don't play
Fender bass.
You know what? Nothing
that
wrong beard, with it. It's a fine
that's
product.
That's not a real beard.
It's
either.
Not.
You
really?
You can see the glue. Yeah,
convince
you can
me.
See it's a glue-on job.
That's right.
Yeah.
But I got more.
Mm-hmm. He got more.
Yeah.
He got more out
too
of us
much.
Than he ever should
too
have gotten.
Too much more.
Enough of my yakking.
Yeah, plenty.
What do you say?
Let's boogie.
That's the smartest thing you've said all night. This is the sad part when we're talking about all the deaths of all the drummers.
Yeah, I think Marty was trying to lead us in this direction,
I know.
Actually.
I mean, he was trying to pull this sort of black cloth over everything. It was like, where's
that's
the joy?
Cloth.
Where's the joy, I want to know.
As if this was somehow our fault.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
What I, you know, that's what I thought he was getting at.
You know, it's like those nature shows that you see where they set this trap for a tiger or a mongoose. He was setting a trap, wasn't he?
And well, we were his mongoose, weren't we?
Or a tiger.
Yeah.
There's Ian.
Oh, bloody hell, Ian.
So I want large bread so that I can put this...
Right.
See, yeah. I don't think you're being unreasonable.
And I don't know why he's doing a close-up.
Are you wearing makeup? Are you wearing makeup on your hands?
I think it's all part.
Yeah, I always
it's
wear
all
makeup
part
on
of
my
that.
Hands.
They look great.
Yeah, thank you.
They really look young.
It's all part of the hatchet job he was doing, though. Really.
And
see, and that's another really fantastic version of commentary. Is the what do you call it? The in character commentary.
Yeah, or the commentary by the characters in the film.
Right, and I know obviously that was the Spinal Tap issue. Was there other films that did that?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the inverse on the Spinal Tap was when the Criterion Laserdisc came out of Spinal Tap in the 90s.
Right.
It did have a commentary track with Michael McKean, Harry Shearer, and Christopher Guest as themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And to my knowledge, it was the only time they ever talked about Spinal Tap out of character.
Right.
Hi, I'm Christopher Guest, and I essayed the role of Nigel Tufnell, lead guitar player, in Spinal Tap. We had known each other
Michael
for
McKean
years.
And I had gone to college in the mid-60s in New York City, and we had played music together starting in about 67. When we were all located here, Harry Michael and I, we started working on the TV show. It was 78, wasn't it?
Yeah. Near the end of the show was a parody of a popular late-night rock music show of the time called Midnight Special. Rob Reiner played Wolfman Jack. And we played this with Loudon Wainwright and Russ Kunkel. We played this band called Spinal Tap. And that's the first time they existed. With a totally different logo, too. We had $50,000 to write a first draft screenplay. of the movie. And we gathered in his hotel room for about 3 days trying to write a screenplay. And just at the end of the third day or something, he said, this is like a stupid thing to be doing. Nobody's ever going to be able to make sense of this on paper. Let's see if they'll let us take the money and make a demo of the movie instead.
Hi, fellas.
Fran Drescher really does talk like that.
And this was one of the amazing discoveries, because we had used some people in the film that we knew and who we knew could improvise, and Fran came out of nowhere and this is her. She's just going here. She has none of these lines are written. She's
so perfect.
She's just smacking it.
Yeah.
We went to every major studio in town, I think, with this 20-minute demo under the four of us, Rob and Chris and Michael and I. And you've never seen blanker stares on the faces of major film executives after they'd seen this 20 minutes, and they'd say, well, yeah, so?
And your point is?
Word being.
What they actually said was, I can't sell this. And there was one guy who looked at it, and he said, you know, it's really, really funny, but what you need, it's in the very beginning, you need a joke like they have an airplane, where you see the shark fin style tail fin go through the clouds so that people know that it's a funny movie. We thought that we had left a few tips that it was supposed to be funny in there in the 20 minutes.
You've got to remember, they've done hundreds of interviews in character.
Right.
Hundreds.
Right.
All from promoting the movie and the various tours that they've gone on over the years.
Right. This, for all of us, because we're actors and musicians, is the ultimate fantasy, is that you can do a movie where you're acting and hopefully being funny and playing music. Give me a break. It's like show business camp. The extension of that when we go on the road is being let loose in front of, you know, thousands of people is absolutely. And it fulfills a number of levels, because we're playing songs that are fun to play, where you get to play and you're really playing and you're having fun and singing and you're
cavorting.
Yeah,
romping. And caveling.
Anticking.
Also, I mean, when we're on the road, especially when we're doing media stuff or being observed, we're staying in character. So the tour and the build-up to the tour was actually a much longer period of acting as these characters than the movie.
The movie was 5 weeks out of our lives.
Yeah. The tour and the build-up to the tour was like 3/4 of a year.
Yeah.
Most of the days...
The second tour.
Yeah, second tour. Most of those days spent in character improvising with each other in front of strangers.
Another element in that is that the three of us like to make each other laugh, and that's a huge part of it, because, you know, you're sitting with morning men, and because they get it. You know? And so we're basically playing to each other, and again, we've never heard what we're going to say, and that becomes that kind of little challenge.
To be able to do the Spinal Tap tour in 1992, we had to take this thing that we had created between 1980 and 1982 and to put it on the road in 1992. We had to follow a trail that went through the bankruptcies of three movie studios to this company called Parafrance, which is a subsidiary of L'Oreal Cosmetics, and negotiate a deal to buy back the rights to use our own creation, which was an 18-month process. We would have gone on tour the previous year, except that the negotiations for the rights to be Spinal Tap hadn't been completed by then. It was the most arduous, crazy, expensive, lunatic part of this thing, is like to buy back the rights to our own creation, because to make the movie, we had to give up all rights to everything excepting our firstborn. We don't own the publishing on the music, and we didn't even own the right to be Spinal Tap. And when we went on tour, our manager approached the people who had the publishing to the original songs, because we'd written a whole bunch of new songs. And he said, well, listen, why don't you give us a piece of these songs? It'll be kind of an incentive for us to perform them on the tour. Their response was, we are in the business of acquiring things, not giving them away. We have a license, a limited-in-time license to use the characters and the name, and every time we use it, the license is automatically extended. But if we go through a period of 3 years without using the characters or in any way, it reverts, and we have to go through the whole thing again. So that, in a way, is a strange incentive to resurface from time to time, just to keep our right to be these guys.
It's now out of print. I mean, we have to file that in the lost commentary track, but... Mm-hmm. That particular track by those three guys, and it had one by Rob Reiner and Karen Murphy. But I think that Criterion version of the DVD is now out of print and goes for quite a lot of money on eBay.
Good album. Good album. Classic. You can't get it now.
No.
On eBay, you can.
I know that they're out there. And those are, you know, if you're really into that type of thing, I think those can definitely be a lot of fun. I mean, hell, I know that it was fun for me it's kind of the flip side of that to listen to the Pee-wee's Big Adventure commentary, because you got Paul Reubens doing the commentary on there.
Mm-hmm.
And to hear Paul Reubens out of the Pee-wee character discuss Pee-wee is a lot of fun.
Yeah, definitely.
So it's kind of the flip side of that, saying, okay, here's someone who we rarely see out of character, because, you know, when Pee-wee was as big as he was, he would go to shows or different things as Pee-wee. You very rarely heard, you didn't hear Paul Reubens talk a lot.
Well, it makes that commentary track that much more special if you are a fan of that performer or that act.
Right.
So it makes it something unique you wouldn't get anywhere else.
Right. So, yeah, those in characters are a blast.
But going back to some of the other, you know, different types of commentaries, I mean, I know we talked a little bit about The Historian.
Right.
I know that the current Citizen Kane DVD has a commentary track by Roger Ebert.
Mm-hmm.
And also by Peter Bogdanovich, which is kind of great because you get two sides. I mean, mm-hmm. Bogdanovich knew Wells very well.
Mm.
Had asked him many questions about Kane and other films. So, whereas on the other hand, Ebert's is very technical, very academic. It's someone that has seen the film probably 100 times.
Right.
Has shown it in classes and lectured on it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very informative track in terms of things to look for and that you'll learn, and it will make your next viewing of Citizen Kane that much better mm-hmm. by listening to that track. And I mean, didn't Ebert also do a track for Dark City? Do you remember that film?
Yeah, I'm not sure.
I mean, it's kind of rare that Ebert does, you know, would commit to a commentary track.
Mm-hmm.
But he seems an ideal candidate to do commentary tracks in a lot of ways.
But, I mean, yeah, it's a pretty common thing now, this film historian, a lot of times for directors who've passed on. I know that there's a lot of work like that on all the new Leone films that just got re-released.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've got the film historians on the Peckinpah sets. We've got the film historians coming in. And really, I think, you know, it's kind of the next best thing. But at the same time, you know, it might be, you know, as far as Peckinpah goes, maybe a Kris Kristofferson might be even more fun.
I do think that there's a great opportunity with this commentary track to do something for the library, for
mm-hmm.
history.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when the DVD market exploded, I know there was some controversy because Schwarzenegger wanted to be paid
mm-hmm.
for his commentary tracks.
Right.
And normally it was just expected you come in and do it for free.
Because it's a promotional item, right?
It's a promotional item for the film.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it upset the balance a little bit when I guess he got paid for the Total Recall track, I think.
Right. Well, I guess we'll call it the star commentary where, you know, and you're right. It does change everything when these guys get paid for it. And you know what I say? Yeah, pay them. Because, I mean, it's a feature on a disc. I mean, I can tell you that when I heard that Schwarzenegger was going to do the Total Recall commentary, I was ready for that. That's one of the most anticipated discs that I wanted for a long time.
That's right.
Because I wanted to hear his take. He had not done a commentary before, and I wanted to hear Arnold.
He hadn't done the Conan one yet?
Yeah, I don't remember if he had done the Conan one or not. But the problem is that, you know, in the end, we found out that Arnold's not such a great commentary guy.
Well, this is me, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and this is me on the screen here, riding towards the camera.
You know, it's Arnold falls into another category very badly, you know, which is basically the play-by-play commentary.
The play-by-play.
You know, yeah. Which is a whole nother kind of commentary, you know, it's where basically they just tell you, you know, it's like a sports game, you know. Here's why I'm going to punch the camel.
Oh, that's funny.
mm-hmm. Boom, and he punches the camel, and it's just like, yeah, that was good, you know, and it's just, yeah, it's...
Well, they just relay the whole movie for you.
Right.
And really don't tell you anything you didn't already know.
Right.
That wasn't already obvious.
Exactly.
I mean, luckily on the Conan track, he's got John Milius.
Which helps
and Milius
immensely.
And Milius certainly has something to say.
Sure.
There were going to be three Conan movies. It was going to be a trilogy. And the first one was Strength. And that's why it is the building of the sword. The second one was how the sword is used. And the third was the consequences.
And he can say it well. So it does balance out that track. And them two laughing is kind of engaging enough.
Well, see, Arnold works best, kind of like Kurt Russell works best with Carpenter. It's, you know, get him in there with someone else and they can bounce off each other. You know, you get him in there alone and it's probably going to be pretty damn dry.
Well, this is what I call sort of the buddy commentary thing. And I've been seeing it more and more lately
mm-hmm.
To where... you know, instead of just having one person, they'll want to bring somebody in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they can talk. You know, like an actor or director wants to bring in an actor and so forth.
Right.
I mean, one of the lost commentary tracks is the original Alien track, which was Ridley Scott by himself.
Right.
On the first release of Alien on DVD. But when the Quadrilogy set came out, they had a whole new commentary track, and he's with Sigourney Weaver in that one.
Mm-hmm.
So, really, while the Sigourney Weaver one is fun, they're laughing, reminiscing, and so forth,
mm-hmm.
he's not covering the same things he's covering in that original commentary track.
Right.
You know, it kind of makes me wish they still would have included the Ridley solo one.
The best technology ever presented probably was in 2001, Stanley Kubrick. And so it was very difficult because Stanley had done that, and it was and still is one of my favorite films. If I had to say, you know, if you, what's your 20 favorite films, that would have to be in there. And therefore, it was tricky not to get influenced by what he'd done. Of course, what he had done, I think, A, had worked closely with finding out what NASA speculative designs were or would be. So when you think about 2001 and you look at what's happening today, he's still ahead of the game.
Instead of just this this new one that they produced for the disc. I like the idea of the buddy. I mean, of course, you mentioned the Carpenter, Russell.
Mm-hmm.
Their commentaries are very endearing in that way.
Right.
So this is the third time that you and I had worked together because we did Elvis before Escape.
The main title, Burn Through, it's exactly the same as the original thing. We copied their logo exactly.
You know, it's funny, when people watch the movie, that's what they have. And interestingly enough, we can never have that experience because we made it. But what we do have that nobody else has was the making of it. And that's the great joy. And it was disappointing, I remember, at the time to watch the movie not do well in the theater.
A little different monster for the audience. Wasn't it the same year that E.T. came out?
As a matter of fact, we came out 2 weeks after E.T. came out.
That's what it was.
And theirs was sweet and ours was mean.
But I must say, over the last 13 years now, it has been a great pleasure to have people come. Movies that you do like this, that you put a lot into and you had a lot of feeling and you thought it was a really good movie, when people come up to you on the street and they say, hey, The Thing.
I know, that's a great feeling, isn't it?
It's a great feeling, yeah, it really is. You know, it's like, what is it, Von Ryan's Express, if just one gets away, well, if just one person enjoys it, then you feel like you. The only thing we did know at this point was that MacReady was not, right?
Didn't he could have been.
Yeah, that's true. Here we go again.
I mean, he was just, we didn't see him for a while.
I mean, a commentary track that I remember I couldn't wait to hear was the Michael Mann, James Caan for Thief.
How'd you do that, Mike? Make it look like it was raining. How'd you do that? You're a genius.
This thing weighs about 200 pounds. It's a magnetic drill. We had all the real guys there.
Yeah.
And you came in, you went, go ahead, Jimmy, bust a beat. Wait, where's the prop? They had no from props, you remember?
Yeah.
And that thing bucked in the middle of it?
Yeah.
And when I did it, I got a round of applause from the guys. Yes, that was terrific.
What Jimmy's talking about is there were no props on the film. There's no reason to have props.
There was a reason.
There was a reason. We just didn't do it that way.
It
kind of limited the authenticity. I knew that Jimmy really needed the totality of his performance.
Absolutely.
So we just got actual safes, and we got one of the technical advisors.
The technical advisor. That's a fancy name. For thieves.
Some of the thieves working on the film, we got their burglary tools that they had in their drops, and we bought safes, and we just opened the safes and used the tools.
This is absolutely 100% legitimate what we're doing here.
You know, hearing the two of them laughing and sort of like two old college buddies is a fun way. And I know one director who refuses to do a commentary track by himself is Steven Soderbergh.
Really?
Hi, this is Neil LeBute, director of In the Company of Men, here with director Steven Soderbergh.
Hi, this is Steven Soderbergh. I'm here with Jim Cameron.
Jim Cameron here.
And we're going to try and talk you through this. This is Steven Soderbergh.
And this is Scott Frank.
And now here's a classic example of a stubborn filmmaker. For months, Michael Schamburg was telling me, you have to have music at the front of the movie to just set the mood. You know, it's no good if it's just quiet, because I used to just have the street sounds here. And I kept saying, you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong. I got really steamed at him at a meeting at Universal once. And I think it's because I knew he was right, and I was really resisting it.
Also, for a while, we had to have the Universal music over the logo.
That's true. We did win that battle.
And his commentary tracks are really good, and I certainly would recommend them to anyone that's seeking out some interesting commentaries. But Soderbergh likes to bring in somebody to offset him, so it's just not him. Mm-hmm. When he did the Sex Lives commentary, he brought in the director, Neil LaBute.
Yeah, I didn't want any credits up front. I usually try to get away with not having credits up front. I'm a big believer in starting the movie as quickly as possible. And
well, you did both. And the way you started is interesting, because, you know, your camera is very, in a way, I mean, there's some very innovative shots, but it's very staid. I mean, you have a very sort of voyeuristic, like, along with the theme of the film, and yet you start with this very quick moving shot.
It's a pretty simple movie stylistically, which was partially a result of the budget and partially my not wanting to get in the way. And I'm sure you know what I mean. Which is, you know, if you've cast well and things are going well, you try and just let the scenes play, let the actors go.
The beautiful thing about this, and being at sort of the vanguard of this latest independent film movement, is that it didn't feel like a calling card saying, here's everything I've ever thought of doing in a movie and I'm going to cram it in. You know, it felt very much like...
Well, that's hard to resist when you think this may be the only chance
I ever
get.
Since he was a fan of the film, he was throwing a lot of questions Soderbergh's way. And whenever Soderbergh did have a question, he was commenting. So it was really engaging in terms of having somebody that didn't have anything to do with the movie, but who's a fan of the movie, come in and do the commentary track with the director. And Soderbergh has taken on this idea, and he's used his relationship with other directors, John Borman being one. He did a commentary track with Point Blank.
Hi, I'm Steven Soderbergh. I'm here with John Borman. Very lucky to be here with John Borman to talk about Point Blank, which is a film that I've stolen from so many times that I'm very excited to talk to you about how it came together, because it went together so interestingly.
But in terms of that structure you're asking about, Lee Marvin, when I came out to the studio, MGM, and he called a meeting with the head of the studio and his agent and the producers, and he said, I have script approval. They said, yes, and I have... approval of principal cast, yes. He said, I defer those approvals to John, and he walked out. So in my very first film in Hollywood, I had final cut, and I made use of it. When we finished the picture and I showed it to the executives, they were all very perplexed, and they were mumbling about reshoots. And Margaret Booth, who was the sort of supervisor,
legendary Margaret Booth.
And she was...
And is a very traditionally minded editor.
Yes.
Or at least had that reputation.
Absolutely. And she said to me, as they were filing out, she's sitting in the back of the screening room, toasting her feet on a little electric fire. She said, you touch one frame of this film over my dead body. And she made a couple of very nice suggestions, which I... were really helpful, and the picture went out like that.
It's so interesting that she would, you know, look at it and just get it immediately.
And Mike Nichols being another. They did commentary tracks for Catch-22, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf.
Hi, I'm Steven Soderbergh. I'm here with Mike Nichols. We're going to try and talk our way through Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. There's a lot to talk about. There's... an account of one of your initial meetings, or maybe your initial meeting, where you asked Osteen, can I shoot overlapping dialogue? Can I have people talking on top of each other, and can this still be cut together? And he said, absolutely. And apparently nobody ever said yes to that question before to you.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. They all said, don't overlap. You mustn't overlap. And I said, well, you can't do this piece without overlapping. There was Osteen, who said that, having, I suppose, done it cut overlaps went for whoever he worked for. I mean, the various guys he worked for. But you're right, he was the first. And he turned out to be, as you know, a great editor.
Yeah.
And just recently, The Graduate. So this is Soderbergh, the fan, coming in with a whole yellow pad list of questions that he's always wanted to ask about The Graduate, sitting with Mike Nichols, his fellow director and friend. But I would rather Soderbergh in there rather than having Mike Nichols by himself winging it.
Right, and he's kind of pointing and saying, you know, this. Well, I mean, let me just go off an example here. One of the commentary tracks that drives me crazy that I really hate, and it's, you can kind of put it into two categories because it relates to this, is what I call the battle commentary, okay? Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is the commentary where they do have two different people on there, but a lot of time they're either directed to really keep on point of their perspective, or they're piecing it together from individual commentaries and making them into one. And I can tell you the example I'm going to use is from Die Hard with John McTiernan and the production designer,
Jackson DeGovia.
Right. And part of my problem is that, you know, it becomes like a tug of war. And you hear one guy for a while, you know, the director who I really want to hear, and then it flashes over to the production designer. And I'm not saying that the production designer's stories aren't fantastic, but on certain specific screen items, I want to hear what the director is saying. And so there's this battle going on, and we go through a scene that I wanted to hear what McTiernan had to say about that particular scene, but yet we were listening to a story that the production designer started 5 minutes ago about buying, you know, drapes or something. That is totally not interesting to me. And so I get a little frustrated with commentary tracks like that where there's too many people involved. You know, you could also call this the rework interview commentary piece together.
Well, I think that's what it really is. Right. Is it's like, okay, I need to make a commentary track. I need to build it out of these pieces.
Right.
I think Jackson DeGovia was screen specific.
Mm-hmm.
So he had a complete Jackson DeGovia commentary track, but he just was able to insert the McTiernan ones.
Right.
And that's something Scorsese has been doing as well, because on the recent box set that came out of his films, Who's That Knocking and Mean Streets and Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore and After Hours and Goodfellas and I think Casino also, he doesn't do a commentary over the entire film.
Mm.
He talks.
Mm-hmm.
And either they edit his stuff in between, or it just runs for the first 25 minutes of the movie, and then they start putting in, you know, other comments and so forth. So, I mean, probably his time is precious.
Mm-hmm.
But it is difficult to fill an entire film of talking, especially if your film is 3 hours.
Absolutely, you know? Absolutely.
Some of those need to be recorded in multiple sessions, mm-hmm. I think, to get the best work.
These are tough.
We are rolling.
Just to expect a director, again, to sit down and immediately recall all of that is going to be difficult. So I think the Soderbergh approach is to be noted in terms of, I mean, I'm sure he's doing his homework before he shows up to the recording session to make sure that he's written out enough questions to make an engaging track. So, yeah, I like Soderbergh's approach. I think that's a good idea. But another of the buddy commentaries that we didn't mention that is certainly worth noting, mm-hmm. that made me want to run out and grab the disc was the Robin Hood Prince of Thieves, Kevin Reynolds, Kevin Costner track.
Oh, absolutely.
Considering the famous stories that went on during the making of that movie. I mean, these two guys who had been friends, they made Fandango together.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Costner asked Reynolds to shoot second unit on Dances with Wolves, mm-hmm. Then had him come in and do Robin Hood. But they had their difficulties. I think Reynolds was kicked out of the editing room, and the film got made.
Right.
They patched up their differences. Costner produced Rapanoi. And then they decided, okay, our friendship's back. Let's go make Waterworld.
Well, you know, if you're kind of closeted Kevin Reynolds fans like you and I are, you know, uh-huh. we don't run into other Kevin Reynolds fans very often.
Not too often.
And knowing that relationship makes those commentary tracks really priceless because, you know, a lot of people think that Costner is, you know, kind of egotistical and stuck up. But if you listen to those commentaries, you'll figure out that he's really not. He's quite humble.
Boy, and I know it's on everyone's mind. As soon as you mention Robin Hood, what's the next thing that comes to mind?
His English accent.
And Costner is very direct.
Well, there's my dumbass accent. This was a point of contention for Kev and I, and Kev's, I'll let him say, but I knew in his mind, he said, you know, was Kevin, look, it's not important where this movie's concerned because of the way it lays out. And I was, I need to try and do this. And so I got ridiculed pretty tough, and Kevin let me try and might as well put it out there. It was something I wanted to do, and I wasn't very good at it. If I ever get the chance to do it again, I'm going to do it again, and I'm going to get it right. But I think in the spirit of the commerciality of the movie, you were probably right.
But Costner wanted to give it a try.
Right.
And that's why for the first, like, 4 or 5 days or week, he was trying it. And then it was like, okay, fuck it.
Yeah.
We've got a movie to make here.
I think you use angles better than anybody I've ever worked with. It's amazing when I watch it even now. It's like, it's just exciting how you move the camera.
Well, thanks. I think a lot of the credit goes to Dougie Milsom, too, who shot this.
Well, he did, and he lit it, but I guarantee you, I was standing there, and he did a beautiful job of lighting it, but I know this really is your thing.
The aspect ratio of the frame here, I don't know if you can see it at home, but we shot this in 1.66, which is a pretty square frame, as opposed to normal 1.85. A lot of people now are shooting an anamorphic, which is a much wider frame. And I was just saying to Kevin, I don't really like it because it kills the vertical if you're framing for a vertical object.
Yeah, people try to sell you on the idea that, you know, you're going to have these big horizons, and I'm kind of going the same way. I just finished a Western, and I would have given anything. In fact, when I did some of my effect shots, I actually saw the effect shots, and then you see the whole frame, and I think, wait a second, that's how I should have shot the movie.
Yeah.
He's very humble. His right. Bull Durham is very revealing because right. He's with Tim Robbins.
I have to admit something here that's really real. I was given one of the greatest speeches ever for a character right here, and I never felt, and I'm not looking for a left-handed compliment, and I'm not, I never felt like I did this correctly.
The small of a woman's back, the hanging curveball, high fiber, good scotch, but the novels of Susan Sontag are self-indulgent, overrated crap. I believe Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone. I believe there ought to be a constitutional amendment outlawing AstroTurf and the designated hitter. I believe in the sweet spot, softcore pornography.
It was just beautiful, but I just never felt like I did this right, and I've got so much credit for it. And I think it's the power of words, you know. I think that's why I always got to start with great scripts.
Yeah. I don't know, Kev. I think it's pretty good.
Well, thank you for saying that. But you and I both have directed now, and we know. And I think the power of the words were much stronger than me.
It's a great track. I certainly enjoyed listening to it.
I think the buddy commentary. I mean, I think it's pretty. Across the board that, you know, unless you're really dedicated with your single man commentary, it always seems to work better when you can bounce off somebody. I mean, you know, what would the Hollywood Saloon be like if it was just one of us droning on, you know?
Oh, absolutely. I agree.
So, and I think that's, you know, I mean, really they're podcasting, aren't they? So, these buddy commentaries, but, now back to that idea of the single man commentary, when you have someone who's really driven, I mean, and you know that I'm not the world's greatest and biggest Robert Rodriguez fan, but really, you know, his whole concept, remember he would do that whole 10-minute film school. Mm-hmm. Where he would talk about filmmaking within a span of 10 minutes. But then he applied that same attitude toward his commentary track for El Mariachi. And really, it's a fantastic commentary. And he almost never stops talking the entire time. And it's very detailed. And I find that one fantastic. Even though, like I said, I mean, I do like El Mariachi. I've always been impressed that he was able to pull that off. And I think that really... when you get into that commentary, you hear the entire tale of what it took and what he went through to make that film. Really, he leaves no stone unturned. And that really is almost, you know, another one of the most satisfying commentaries. When you have someone who really wants to get in there and dig in there deep by themselves, the director, you know, the driving creative force behind the film, and really, really dig in there. That's another one of my just most favorite kinds. Yes, I love the single, the director, and I love other crew members in there, but I definitely love, I guess we'd call it the very dedicated director track, where he really wants to get in there and get down deep.
Well, again, anything by Gilliam, anything by Scorsese,
right.
And I'd say anything by Fincher, and anything by Michael Mann, pretty much
covers what you're talking about.
All the Jansen director favorites, right?
All of them are very engaging speakers. They all know their craft. They'll all teach you something you didn't know before you listen to their commentaries.
Right.
I was actually pretty impressed with the Miami Vice commentary from Michael Mann because it really opened up the movie in a lot of ways. Because the movie's very dense, but everything in it is actually a piece. And it's all has like a little, you know, how you remember how you used to do footnotes in school?
Right.
Like whenever you're drawing references, it's like that whole movie's full of footnotes. And he knows where they're all cross-referenced and all the stories and where everything came from.
The economics of the drug trade go something like this. Kraken and Tuz will be paid $3,000 a key to run 1,000 keys into South Florida. They will be told where to pick it up. They'll run it into South Florida. They may or may not warehouse it, and then they'll be told where to drop it off. What Tubbs is proposing is the way that they do it is they don't want to have contact with any of Jose Yarrow's people. What they want to do is they will put that the 1,000 keys into an 18-wheeler. The keys will be in the ignition, and the money will have exchanged hands elsewhere so that the money and the guns and the drugs are never all at the same place at the same time. So Crockett and Tubbs are very skilled in their trade craft. Yarrow, even though he's challenging them, this is really what he wants to hear. He wants to elicit how these guys do business because he doesn't want to entrust 1,000 kilos of flake with Crockett and Tubbs. That means Crockett and Tubbs' end for moving the drugs from point A to point B will be $3 million. The rest of the economics of it is that it costs approximately $500 for Yarrow's organization to produce a kilo of cocaine. That's packaging, moving, all accumulates about $500. That kilo is worth $15,000 on the street of Miami. So the profit multiple is huge.
So when he relates that in talking about the making of the film and what you're seeing on screen, it opens up the movie in a way that the movie can't just be on its own.
The way trafficking organizations actually operate, not in movies, but in real life, as a product of kind of our knowledge base and our research that we did, is exactly how you would think they'd operate if you're talking about a business that has a tremendous cash flow, is highly profitable, and makes a lot of money. If you're running a business like that, what would you do? You would go out, and since you have rather unlimited budgets, you would hire the best money can buy. You would hire the best accountants. You'd hire the best people to manage your money. You would hire the best people to invest your money in some kind of legitimate enterprises so that you could go and spend it. And whether that's shopping centers in Germany or Malaysian tinware futures in Malaysia, that's what you're going to have done. You're also going to hire the best people you can find to run your security and to do counter-intel. The counter-intel you're going to run is everything to do with signal intercept stuff, where you are actually on the DEA's air, you try to get on the FBI's air, to human intelligence, where you're maybe bribing telephone operators in a border town in Texas or somebody in Miami to try and get numbers of cell phones of DEA agents. So these are all the things that you would do if you imagine yourself sitting on top of $1 billion enterprise, and you want that enterprise to run efficiently. What you'd be imitating is business. You are simply in business, and you are in a very big business. So in asking myself as a writer-director, how am I going to characterize Jose Yarrow and the organization that he works in? What is the nature of that organization? You know, what is his corporate structure? What is his business plan? Because that will determine what he wants from Crockett and Tubbs. It'll also determine how his job, how he keeps his job, by being very good at it. And he runs counterintel. He's the man who's responsible for making sure that they don't lose loads. And the language of this meeting and the way it was set up was told to me by a confidential informant who was working for the DEA. I borrowed that interview that I had done with this man and used it here in Miami Vice and gave that language and that and the logic, the character logic behind that language to Montoya. And as Montoya says this one sentence, very striking to me, he says that he doesn't buy a service, he buys a result. That means that you can't screw up and say, well, I tried to and I did everything I said I was going to do, but it didn't work out. That's not what Montoya is buying from you. Montoya is buying from you a happy ending. That's it. You don't provide a happy ending, you're in deep trouble and there's no second chance.
I found it almost just as engaging as watching the film just on it as by itself. But I tell you another commentary I really like, and you can only get it on the Japanese DVD, and that's for Vincent Gallo's The Brown Bunny.
Oh, Vincent Gallo production, okay. That was the signal for everybody at the Cannes Film Festival to start booing. And this written, directed, edited, and produced by, that really got them going. I guess if you do a lot of things, if you multitask and you work hard and sacrifice your relationships, your friendships, your money, and lifestyle, that's considered self-indulgence in America.
Now, this is one I sought out just because, you know, I happen to be a Vincent Gallo admirer. I think he's a very unique filmmaker in a whole sea of just vanilla plainness out there.
Sure.
But he's another one that does every job on his film. And because the Japanese financiers financed the film, he only provided the commentary track for this import DVD.
But there's a lot of talk about the Cannes version and the final version of the film. There's no versions. There's only an incomplete film which was shown at Cannes and my cut of the movie. I am the producer and director of the film, so there's only one cut of the film that I stood behind, which is this one that you're watching. But I did show an incompleted film at Cannes because the Japanese financiers insisted to give me the extra time that I needed to finish the film, that I, in trade for that, I show the film in its incomplete form at the Cannes Film Festival.
He's very revealing about the jerks that he had to work with in dealing with the film.
The girl who's supposed to play this girl here originally was going to be Kirsten Dunst, and she's a jerk, and then it was going to be Winona Ryder, and she's a jerk, and then I just found this girl a couple miles away from this gas station in a little small town and put her in the film. But she's very watchable. She's good. I'm happy that I don't have Spider Girl or Shoplifter in my film. By the way, at the Cannes Film Festival, they've already booed like 3,000 times and 100 people a second have walked out of the cinema. So I guess, I don't know, what are we... 10 minutes into the film or something, and I've already... I don't know. You know, I was a little taken aback by the aggression. But I think a lot of the thing that went against me when I showed this film... Film festivals are very aggressive, and France is ridiculous, and Cannes is ridiculous. So there's a lot of suspicion towards filmmakers when there's sort of negative hearsay about a film. This film had a... You know, a lot of suspicion because of all the multitasking that I did and the graphic scenes. So I don't know. If there's suspicion, my film doesn't have the sort of gimmicks or tools that could sedate that level of suspicion. So instead, you go into this film with a lot of doubts and a lot of reverberation of hearsay and sarcasm towards the film, and then you see something like this, which is at best unusual continuity. I mean, people were taken out of the picture immediately. They turned against me immediately.
Just like he does in his films, he lays himself bare on the commentary track. He loves his film. He's got no problem with it, and I like that out of an artist.
Yeah.
Nothing is going to faze this guy. He made the film he wanted to make. You don't like it? That's okay.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean it's going to change his mind.
Right.
But on the other end of the spectrum, have you ever tried to sit through a Michael Bay commentary?
Hi, this is Michael Bay, and welcome to the Criterion Edition of Armageddon. Why is there a Criterion Edition of Armageddon? Well, I think this movie took me a year and a half of my life, and I'd like to show you some of the pains that I went through.
I always like to get sucked in right when I sit down in my seat. I like to see titles that are interesting. I like to get just start getting engrossed, and that's what I did. I tried to suck. After I did Bad Boys, it came out. It did very well financially. I started getting offers everywhere. The Rock had actually had come to me, and I turned it down 6 months earlier because I just didn't feel the story was there.
I was adamant that we do this bizarre dream sequence.
My idea with The Rock was to take people on a big ride and have fun characters in the movie. This is like an e-ticket ride, kind of one-third into the movie, and, you know, I think it did the trick around the world. It's so far made $340 million.
No, I don't think I'm going to try.
I mean, they say Vincent Gallo's got an ego, but I've never heard more I's and more me's than in a Michael Bay commentary.
Hey, love thyself, brother. Well, on the flip side of that kind of thing, and which, you know, you alluded to a little bit earlier, is the, you know, I don't have much to say commentary, where, you know, I think one of my most anticipated commentaries, and we had talked about, like, you know, knowing what commentaries were coming out and what we were anticipating big time and see if they, you know, met approval. But, man, I was so excited to get that Excalibur commentary. And you mentioned John Borman earlier, and I think, wow, if Soderbergh did a commentary with John Borman, how much better would that be than when he did Excalibur by himself?
By himself, yeah.
Because as much as I respect the hell out of that man and the beauty that is Excalibur, and I was so excited to get into that commentary, it really, there's, you know, he would say something and then the longest gaps, and eventually I shut it down because it was just like, you know, you can't fast forward it because you know you'll miss what he says. Mm-hmm. So you have to write it out, you know, and the sound doesn't come back up, so you can't really watch the movie. It stays down low and you're just waiting for him to say something, and that's one of those commentaries where if you don't have much to say and there's these big long gaps, okay, then you go and get the, you know, the production designer or the editor or somebody like that,
right,
to fill in those holes, because you miss a lot because you'd like to really dig into it, but I don't know if he came unprepared or if he just didn't have a lot to say or if he's kind of a quiet man.
Well, it's probably a combination of a lot of things, but like we talked about, you know, he sat down and when he could think of something, he did. And mm-hmm. you know, he's probably watching it and reminiscing in his head,
right,
as he's looking at the film, because I don't know if a lot of people know this, but a lot of directors just don't revisit their old films like we do.
Right.
Once they make them, they put them away for 10 or 15 years. Mm-hmm. Often the DVD is a chance to sort of relook at it for the first time in a long time.
Right.
No, I mean, thank goodness we have Soderbergh out there, because he does make the point-blank conversation very engaging.
Now, one question I want to ask, because I think this very much plays to the issue of whether this story is happening in his mind or is happening in real life. The way you work with the Keenan Wynn character, to me, is very, very suggestive of an apparition. They're always alone, and yeah. and the quality of their conversations is conspiratorial in such a way that feels very dreamlike to me. And what did you have in mind when you were staging the scenes with the two of them together? Because it seems like you were very specific about how yeah. you shoot them and how they perform.
Well, they never look at each other.
Oh, that's
so you never quite know whether he's really there or not.
I mean, not that I wouldn't take that Excalibur commentary, you mm-hmm. know what I mean? Because those words are golden. But, you know, at the very least, make it a little more palpable to people who don't want to just sit there, you know, and go through the silent tracks.
And then there's the sort of the position of having almost utter contempt for the commentary track to turn it into a giant joke. Like the Coen brothers did for Blood Simple. I don't know. Do you own Blood Simple?
No.
Okay. Well, what the Coen brothers did is they decided to just make a big joke and make a fake commentary. Mm-hmm. And they have Kenneth Loring from Forever Young Films. Mm-hmm. Okay. And he's got one of those film scholar voices.
Uh-huh. Welcome, viewers, to this special collector's edition of Blood Simple, Forever Young. My name is Kenneth Loring, Artistic Director for Forever Young Film Restoration, and I'll be talking you enthusiasts, or shall we say, aficionados, through some of the technical aspects of the filmmaking here, even as the scenes under discussion unfold. But more on myself later during the slower parts of the movie. For now, let's admire some of these so-called plate shots, that is, shots that were filmed as background for titles. Although, here, as you see, there are actually no titles, so they They aren't, in fact, plate shots, but simply, well, shots, I suppose you'd call them.
As he waxes poetic about Blood Simple. And it's quite funny, actually, in a Coen Brothers wry sense of humor type way.
Right.
If you're into their particular bent of humor, the whole commentary track is leaned in that way.
And yes, just as the suspense mounts, the filmmakers answer our question, we are driving in a car. Now, here's a technical aside, though it appears that we're driving, this shot was actually achieved with the car stationary and the illusion of oncoming traffic. You saw the headlights back there, the illusion of oncoming traffic created by a pair of lights being run at us as if they were headlights. And the sense of motion, it's enhanced by technicians who gently rock our, in fact, stationary car.
I don't know who Kenneth Loring is, if it's just an actor they got to do it, or if they do the voices or what. Mm-hmm. But the only commentary track I know from the Coen Brothers was The Man Who Wasn't There.
Right.
Which they did with Billy Bob Thornton.
You know, it's funny, that scene, the story that Gandolfini tells is actually a true story that was related to us by, for all of you film fans out there, Barry Sonnenfeld's father, who was a Marine in New Guinea, on Buna. And originally told us the story about the soldier who was eaten by the Japanese.
I love the dialogue you guys wrote for this movie. I mean,
none of it for you, but...
Yeah, exactly. That's right. Unfortunately.
Somebody will write some for you, Billy. Yeah.
You have James Cameron was talked into coming and doing one for T2, and he brought William Wisher in with him.
Right.
For that, what was it, the Ultimate Edition?
No, that was the Extreme Edition. Well, here's the funny thing is that when the Ultimate Edition came out, we thought, well, that's it. You know, I mean, we've got everything that there's going to be. And no. They got Cameron to do that commentary. And damn if we didn't go buy that Extreme Edition specifically
for the commentary.
For that Cameron commentary.
That was added value enough for me to want to rebuy it.
Right.
Yeah. No, and I am guilty of seeking out commentary tracks specifically, mm-hmm. or seeking out DVDs specifically for their commentary track. I know Cameron for the Titanic commentary. I mean, God, he was a trooper. He did the entire 3-hour, 30-minute movie.
Wow.
And provided, I think a pretty engaging commentary. And one thing he was able to do is sort of answer some of his critics or some of the perceived flaws that some people had pointed out in the film.
Now, we've been criticized for showing a Picasso, Les Demoiselles d'Avignon, when in fact that painting doesn't only resembles Les Demoiselles d'Avignon. It's not an identical copy, and so the idea was that the artist did two works that were roughly similar. So the art critics can kiss my butt. Hi, everybody. This is Jim Cameron. I'm here to comment on my movie Titanic. I always consider it to be a little suspect, this concept of people talking about their movies. In theory, the movie should speak for itself, but given that there is such a big fan base for the film, I'm going to try to fill in some of the nooks and crannies of what you don't already know. And this is a real shot of the Titanic wreck and the Mir submersible. These were shot in summer of 1995 on our first expedition out to Titanic. This is a model shot. The way you can tell is any shot with two subs in it is a model shot. Any shot with one sub in it, like this one, is a real shot. Because obviously one sub had to carry the camera, and the other one was the on-camera character. Turns out these doors are not accurate. When we got inside the Titanic a couple of years ago with our robots, we found out that they're not accurate. So theoretically I should reshoot that scene, but it's not going to happen.
You have a director that I admire a lot who's done two commentary tracks is Michael Cimino.
Mm-hmm.
One was for Year of the Dragon, which not only was just a really informative, educational commentary track about that film, but also about Michael Cimino and his other films and his process.
Mm-hmm. And because I didn't go to film school, I didn't know any better. You know, so I didn't see anything wrong with it, so I just do it. And nobody ever told me what you couldn't do, which was the great advantage of not going to film school and not going studying writing, because nobody ever told me what you shouldn't do. And script girls are very fond of telling me, you can't, that's not going to cut. And I said, yes, it will. And they said, no, it won't. I said, how much are you prepared to bet? And they said, what do you mean? I said, I'll bet you $1,000 it cuts. And one girl took me up on the bet, one script girl, and I showed her the cut. I said, you owe me $1,000. but of course I didn't take it. But I don't know about this business of the eye line, and critics are always saying I cross the eye line and I do this and I do that. And I once tried reading a book about film editing. I got so confused, I had to stop reading it. I couldn't get past page two. And yet I've worked on the editing of Deer Hunter. You know, I live in the editing room. I love the editing room. We decided to go and meet the Chinese gangsters and so-called gangsters. And I got to know them at that time, as well as I knew a lot of certain mafia families, which I won't go into. But what we found was completely contrary to what all of the popular myths were. We were fascinated, both of us. We went, there's such a thing called the Chinese Gun Club. And it's really an organization which allows everybody to carry a gun. And they give equal amounts of money to both mayoral candidates every year. That's the Chinese way, you know. They would give $500,000 to Bush and $500,000 to Kerry. So whoever wins, they're kind of in with.
It was better than having a two-hour Michael Cimino interview. Mm-hmm. For the Region 2 version of The Deer Hunter, there's an exclusive commentary track mm-hmm. by Cimino and the film critic FX Feeney.
Universal is a very familiar logo. The real company that produced it, EMI, and that's a British company, which is very fitting because we're speaking to the listeners and audience members in the UK. Could you talk about that, about EMI?
EMI actually produced the movie. EMI actually financed the movie. It is generally not known that The Deer Hunter could not have been made by an American movie at that time because it was thought there was no audience for this kind of movie then.
Specifically a movie dealing with the Vietnam War.
Yes, America was going through the same kind of political frenzy that the UK is now experiencing over Iraq. And there was great debate, and then a great lull. And The Deer Hunter was kind of released on the cusp of the 80s, the Reagan era. It was simply thought not to be an audience. You have to be careful when you generalize about America, because when people in the media, such as yourself, or someone like my friend Gore Vidal, talk about America, they're always talking from California or New York, specifically L.A. Mm-hmm. and New York City. But very, very rarely do they talk from Fort Worth, Kansas City, St. Louis, Cleveland. None of them have ever been to Gary, Indiana.
Yeah.
I dare say Gore doesn't even know where it is on the map. And they don't understand a lot of America. They understand Los Angeles culture and New York culture. That is not America.
And it was an engaging track. Unfortunately, it is only in Region 2, which kind of brings up this other phenomena out there, is the exclusive commentary tracks. Mm-hmm. The screw you, America, you don't get it.
You're not smart enough to have our commentary tracks.
I mean, there's two John Carpenters. They live in Prince of Darkness that are exclusive to Region 2.
Mm-hmm. One of the most famous scenes in a minute is coming up in this film,
hey,
which
Dad.
People remember, and they remember your line.
He says, say something, Rod.
Here it comes. Andy, this is something you wrote. This is something that actually you had written, and I thought was just brilliant. It's something that you maybe had planned on using.
Oh,
here we go.
Right, that's right.
Yeah, you'd planned on using it at one time, and I thought, you know, this is great. Nobody else would
say
something
like that.
You had that
little book we shared.
You had the book that you let me see your material, and it was great. I thought, this is perfect.
I have come
and it kind of came emblematic of you and the movie. Yeah.
But
fascinating.
And I'm all out of bubble gum. Which is interesting. When we were doing it, I never thought that line would... I mean, I wasn't doing that line because it was going to be, what is Schwarzenegger said, see you later, baby. I never did that line, or you never had me do that line as going to be the line of the movie. So it's like, you never know. You never know what's going to catch on.
No, you never know. Okay, now we're about to start one of the great fight scenes in movie history. I go that far to say I think it's... because I think, look, it's a real fight. It's not a flashy fight in terms of you guys don't have kung fu going, you don't have martial arts, you're not flying through the air.
No.
You're just going at it.
Two rounders.
Yep. And I'm gonna brag on you now because you guys rehearsed this fight two months in my backyard.
Your backyard, a long time.
On and on.
Yeah.
And you had it down. You guys are making contact in this fight, and I'm really proud of both of you for being able to. You trusted by that point. You knew what you were gonna do.
Trusted each other.
Yep. You knew how to pull it off.
There's also, I mean, we have the lost commentary tracks that we had on Laserdisc that are gone. That Fisher King commentary track, the very first one I ever heard, is not available on DVD.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Minor, to be sure. I can hear people out there right now going, yeah, so the fuck what?
Right.
And it's one of the best ones still to this date that I've ever heard.
Now, and why is this? This is because... rather than buy it from Criterion, they just figure, let's just do it again?
Or not do it at all. There's only a bare-bones edition of Fisher King.
Right.
So they have not decided to put anything into it. Criterion does not give away their supplements because that's what they have there. That's their value.
Right.
In the late days of Laserdisc, it was no problem for the studio to license a film to Criterion.
Right.
Because Laserdisc was such a small market. It's like, you know... they want to do some deluxe, let them go off and do all that work. We're not going to go do it.
Right.
But then Criterion proved that people would pay $124 for a Laserdisc. Mm-hmm. So certain studios like Universal started doing their own deluxe line of Laserdiscs and adding commentary tracks and, you know, bonus content. I mean, Lorenzo Balzaru has created a whole industry in doing those behind-the-scenes documentaries and stuff. And he started out in the Laser days. The 7 Criterion commentary track for the Laserdisc.
I think, you know, our responsibility is bring people into the dark and make them feel something. And I don't think our responsibility is always to pander to this, to tying it up in a nice, neat little package. You know, sometimes you can't make it make sense.
Well, what was there was Somerset talking about how his father, at age 13... had given him a book on forensic pathology. He was actually hooked by pathology, forensics. That's what kind of detective he is.
Thank you.
Same kind of detective that Sidney Poitier played in the Heat of the Night. So he has grown up with the idea of being a policeman, of being able to solve puzzles.
Screenplays are fun. Funny things, because they're invariably the things that you like about them are in a way kind of the gaps in logic and the rough edges and the leaps that characters kind of make that is far more valuable than any kind of honing or planing or sanding that you can kind of do to make the thing smooth, that you invariably lose some of the human and tactile, you know, living qualities that screenplays have. And I was convinced at the beginning that this was a script that really worked because it was a kind of three different ideas. It was a buddy movie, and then it sort of jettisoned that idea, and then it became this movie about tracking the serial killer, and then it jettisoned that idea, and it really became about how do the innocents and how do the experienced and how do the zealots deal with evil.
It's so really, you want both if you're a fan of Seven.
Well, if you're, if you're a completist and one doesn't always have to replace the other, I mean, absolutely.
But the game, again, with Fincher, only on Criterion Laserdisc, and it also had Michael Douglas on the track.
This picture followed a lot of things in my own personal life. I was in the middle of going through a divorce myself when this picture was going, when the game was going on, and it was a time for me to use a lot of myself in the picture. And I think you just have to decide in the films how much and where that's going to happen. So it's nice to hear the sense of. It's taken me a long time to believe that I had enough charisma, or whatever it might be, screen presence, that I had to do something. It's taken a long time to simplify and be able to trust yourself and not believe that you had to do more. And David was very helpful in that area on this picture.
In CRS, you didn't want it to seem secretive. It wants to seem open, and you want to see all these things going on, and you want to see that there's computers involved in this endeavor, and high technology involved in it, and CAT scans, and it's medical, and it's, you know, these guys have, they've figured it out. These guys have done their homework, and they know more than you, you know. There's also an aspect of the confidence game.
Oh, it's a game.
A game.
Specifically tailored for each participant. Think of it as a great vacation, except you don't go to it. It comes to you.
Is even though the background is telling you they're capable of anything, right? They've got all these SGIs and they've got all, you know, these phone systems, and they've got a medical examination thing, and they've got MRI, and they've got all this cool stuff, and they have this weird screening room where they show you these things, and who knows what how it all works together. It's bigger than you can possibly imagine. But the face of the company is this guy who's eating his Chinese food, and he doesn't know where he's put that thing, and, oh, you don't have to worry about that. And you get this feeling like you're smarter than him, or you're more organized than him. So if some smoothie did that to you, some guy who's really slick, you'd be instantly on your heels, because you'd see the capability. You see through the walls, the glass walls all around him, you see that these guys have, they got an enormous financial backing for whatever it is that they're doing. They've got the ability to do anything, and now who, and why would you want to sign up for that if you don't know what it is? And if the guy seems like he's really smart and really sharp and really, and you know, of course we have this instantaneous distrust for anybody who seems brilliant this day and age.
And it also had the two writers. So, I mean, it was, you know, a nice balance of the creative forces behind that film.
Right.
I know the Evita Criterion was an exclusive to them that has not been made available. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there's tons more. I mean, I know there's websites out there dedicated to, you know, commentaries not yet on DVD. Mm-hmm. If you're interested in these kind of things, they are going to get lost. I know there was some Vaughn commentaries that came on Laserdisc that have been deleted. I guess Criterion has sold their Raging Bull commentary, finally showed up on that special edition disc when it came out.
Right.
And they've sold a couple of the others. I don't think they should have to give it away. And I think it's sad that the studio won't relicense the film to them.
Right.
And just let Criterion put out their edition.
Right. As far as I'm concerned, it's kind of like, if there's already a product out there, let's just move it over from one to the next, if that's at all possible. Because really, when you get two... Now, with the exception, if the idea is that one replaces the other, you do a new one and you don't need the old one anymore, well, that's fine, but who's to say it's as diligent as the first one was? Well, like you were saying, it's like you kind of got watered down, Ridley, when you combined it with Sigourney Weaver. You kind of got the watered down, so you don't have the original, you know, very detailed commentary track. And that's a shame to lose that. But at the same time, I mean, I can't imagine them having put out that quadrilogy set without some sort of commentary. And if it wasn't going to be available, then by all means, let's do something, you know.
Well, it just makes me hold on to my original DVD. That's all.
Right.
I want it, I have it. It's the same thing for Gladiator.
Mm-hmm.
Ridley re-recorded it for that extended cut with Russell Crowe.
Right.
So you want that one, but it's a different commentary track than the one he recorded solo.
Mm.
I mean, he's talking about different things.
Right.
So, I mean, he's repeating a lot of stuff, too.
Mm-hmm.
But there's going to be different content in there.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're a fan of the film, I mean, I guess that's what they're training us to do, is just keep everything, right?
What I've always said is that the sad thing about DVDs is that they very rarely sell two editions. It's normally that one kind of takes over for the other one, and the other one either hits the 550 rack and is slowly weeded out, or it just disappears altogether, and then you have the new default disc. But if, you know, there may be features on there, including new different commentary tracks, that get lost.
What if you're a fan of Ferris Bueller?
Yeah, and that's a damn shame, because I had that commentary track by John...
John Hughes.
By John Hughes.
It's the only one he's ever done.
Right. And
did not do Breakfast Club. He didn't do 16 Candles,
right,
or Uncle Buck.
It was great to have that Ferris Bueller commentary. And damn, I loaned it to a friend and I never got it back again. You know how that goes. And he moved away, and I got screwed. And then they decided that, you know, oh, well, we're not going to, you know, have that anymore. And that's a completely
lost.
Well,
they put out the Bueller edition with all these extras, but they don't have the commentary. They left off an asset.
Right. So what you do is you're going and you're not upsizing. You're really downsizing when it comes to that. Talk about DVD ripoff.
I'm John Hughes. I wrote and directed Ferris Bueller's Day Off. After the film wrapped, Mr. and Mrs. Bueller in real life got married. At the time that we were shooting this, Jennifer Grey and Matthew were dating. It was kind of a strange situation because everybody in this scene is in love. We played this this shower sequence as if he were, again, like a child. He does lots of things that, you know, kids do at bath time. You know, he plays with his hair and he sings to the microphone and covers the camera when he washes his privates while he talks about politics, which I thought was a good context for him to discuss, you know, how he feels about politics. This opening sequence and the end were both shot at the back of the schedule, which was important for the film because it you met him after he'd been playing, you know, for me, he'd been playing the part for 2 months shooting the other sequences. So here, this first piece, he was very, very practiced. This was a very good moment for him. I thought he really had, this is the essence of Ferris. And he's quoting the Beatles, this very, very obvious remark from John Lennon. And he's doing it with just the right amount of smirk, because you don't know if he really believes it or not. And I think that was sort of key to Ferris. You know, was he... You think you would know him. You've just seen him take a shower. You've been with him in the bathroom. You think you know him, but you don't really.
I mean, they did the same thing with The Bourne Identity. They did, like, this new Ultimate Edition.
Mm-hmm.
And they left off the Doug Liman commentary and had a different one with the producers and writer and stuff.
No thanks.
Yeah, I mean, because those things are just going to get lost forever.
Right.
I was thinking of another Gilliam was Baron Munchausen.
Right.
Criterion had a really nice deluxe package of that one. And, you know, Jack Nicholson has done, one commentary for The Passenger, the Michelangelo Antonioni film.
I suppose the thing about an interlinear to this picture should be about Michelangelo Antonioni. In this period, they had what they call the art film. We first became aware of Antonioni with a picture called La Ventura. And this picture, The Passenger, was probably the biggest adventure in filming that I ever had in my life. The first piece of the film in this desert is a man looking for something, and that's really enough of a story for Antonioni. That shot was the reason that they built the hotel. The hotel, in order that the camera be able to dolly out through those bars and out the window, and I hope Michelangelo doesn't mind my revealing the magic of his work, was that the entire hotel could be mounted on a crane and broken in half so that they could go out into the courtyard, shoot, film back toward the hotel after they'd exited, with the hotel having been pushed back together and reconstructed for the remainder of the shot. Wasn't the skill of the shot so much when he was asked why he conceived this one of the most memorable shots in movies? Michelangelo was asked, why did he do all of this? And his answer was very simple. He said, you know, I just didn't want to film the death scene.
Nicholson was a big fan of the film, and it was not a big hit on its release, and he owned the rights to it. And when it finally came out on DVD, he sat down and recorded an entire commentary track for the whole length of the film.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're not familiar with the film, certainly to have his recollections on it is about as good as anything you're going to get.
Right. Well, that's definitely something, like you said, to seek out. Now, another commentary track that I just want to kind of laugh at and make fun of here is the gimmick commentary track. They put out that video commentary for the Jerry Maguire special edition.
I remember that. I couldn't even get through it.
God, and it was so horrible because here we basically what it is that, you know, the main cast and the director are watching the film, and instead of it being any kind of commentary where they're adding anything, it's just them laughing and talking to each other while they watch a movie. We're watching them watch the film, and you can watch it with video, or you can turn the video off and just hear it, but you're not learning anything really about the film, which is a shame because I really love that film.
And it's the only one Cruise has done, I think, too.
Right. Well, and he sits there with his hat over his eyes the entire time. He looks like he's embarrassed, and, you know, he shouldn't be there. And, you know, and occasionally he laughs about this and that, and it's just there's not much, you know, there needed to be some strong direction there, you know, by the director or something, into saying, you know, we're going to, you know, transmit some interesting information here rather than just pose for the camera and laugh as we watch this film. I mean, I really am not interested in watching a celebrity watch a film.
I mean, I think the idea of the audio commentary is great, but the video commentary is less interesting to me. And it changes the focus of the performer because now they're in front of the camera and commenting.
Right.
Whereas I feel like if they're just commenting, they're going to be a lot looser in what they're going to say and how they're going to do it. And they won't have to be so self-conscious of anything else around them.
Right.
But Crow has a great commentary track with his mom on Untitled.
Well, seeing that makes total sense.
But also another one that kind of falls in that category, guy would come back to Soderbergh again. I guess he'll just sort of be our... our champion of this, our crusader of this show, was the Schizopolis commentary for Criterion. Soderbergh interviewed Soderbergh.
I'm here talking with Steven Soderbergh. Tell me a little about how this project originated. Well, actually, this was something that was developed for David Lean. Really? Would this have been before or after his death? It was about, I think, 2 years after he died. And we were talking, and he said that he was looking to do a comedy. He hadn't really done a full-blown, knockdown comedy since Ryan's Daughter. And so we started kicking around a few ideas and had kind of come up with a template for the script of Schizopolis. And then, I don't know, he lost interest. I turned around one day and read in the trades that he was going to, that he was attached to some television show that Showtime was doing. So I took that as an indication that I could sort of proceed on my own.
That's funny. So it was just him versus him.
And at the time that you were making Schizopolis, your career was, I don't know, I guess I saw several articles that would fall under the, what I would call, where are they now, style or type. Well, you know, I'd made Sex Lies, of course, which was a huge international success. And then I made Kafka, which was also a huge international success. And then I made King of the Hill, which was pretty successful, at least in the areas where I was living at the time. And then I made a fourth film that I can't remember the name of. Yeah, then I started the shooting of Schizopolis. And I don't know, I felt it was actually, I was sort of at the peak of my powers here and really couldn't do wrong as far as I was concerned.
And if you're saying, what the hell is a Schizopolis? Well, if you type in Steven Soderbergh to your Netflix queue, you can find this movie and put it in your queue. It is a quite unique film. You haven't seen anything like it. And doesn't matter how many films you've seen, you still haven't seen anything quite like this. But this is the movie he made to try and get back his love and energy of making movies again.
Talk a little bit about the whole idea of making a movie about someone who works in an office, because I happen to know that you've actually never worked in an office. And so should we be taking any of this as being, based in any sort of reality? Well, I don't know. I've never killed anybody, but I've made movies in which people are killed. So I figured, just because I'd never worked in an office, that didn't mean I couldn't make a movie about somebody who worked in an office.
The fact that he interviews himself is in the monotone way that he does it is... It can get kind of repetitious, and you might not find the joke so funny after a while, but he's consistent with it.
But it's kind of gimmicky, yeah.
He goes all the way. I'm certainly glad it's on that DVD.
Right.
But he's got another great track with The Limey that's worth noticing.
Mm-hmm. I was the one that asked for the scene. I said I want a big monologue.
Well,
Do you think there's scenes that directorially I think are great?
I was very careful in the script to only have, I think, one instance of Cockney rhyming slang.
It ground the movie to a halt.
Be very clear that there's a side street, but you don't want any backstory for the human relationships or characters.
Despite what you think, I do like people.
God damn it, people are going to know there's a second way down that hill.
I've certainly made movies that are about nothing but that.
Leave that motherfucker in Variety.
How are we doing? Are we having trouble? Is it?
Yeah, no, exactly. I think,
these are tough.
He gets with the writer, Lim Dobbs, and they go at it. Mm-hmm. They're friends, but, I mean, the writer is very quick to point out all the inefficiencies in Soderbergh's finished film.
I do think, I tell people, they say to me, do you like this movie? And I have to say, as a completely disinterested, objective film goer, I think it's a good movie. I think if I knew nothing more about it and had nothing to do with it as a film goer, I would say that's a good movie. I'd recommend it to my friends. As a screenwriter, I do think it's crippled.
Yeah, but see, that's the first one's the only one that matters.
What do you mean?
The objective film goer position. That's the only one that matters.
No,
that's
doesn't.
The only one I think about.
Well,
do you
no,
think there,
because
don't
I think,
you think there's scenes that directorially I think are great that I think, gee, I hate cutting that, but I cut it because the movie has to come first?
No, I do think it's your Achilles heel. I don't think it's just this film or our previous film. I think it's a problem that you have. I think a lot of your films could use an extra 10 minutes, and certainly this one. I mean, I think this is a good film. I really do. But I think it would be a much better film. I think you would have won over a few of the bad reviews.
But who gives a shit about you?
Well, first of all, I'm not bothered by bad reviews, for one. Secondly, I'd rather have a character be perceived as thin or shallow than have a character who I think is approached in a sort of reductive fashion and explained more than I think, I would like to see it explained. So I do tend to err on the side of less. But that just reflects my taste in what I like to see in a movie.
No, I agree with you on the one hand. I just don't know if it's executed properly.
When are you going to direct?
If you'd get it right, I wouldn't have to.
Well, I'm not going to, so you got to get off your seat.
I don't want to. I don't want to get up at 6 a.m. for months on end. Have to deal with this. I want you to do it.
It's a fun chance for the writer to finally say, look, just because you see the finished film doesn't mean there were problems in the screenplay.
Right.
And I think that's something people forget often. They blame the writer for the finished film, but often it might have very little resemblance to their finished film.
Gee, I haven't seen it before where you're introduced to a character and you sort of see a trailer of the character you're about to see for the rest of the film. Of the character you're about to see for the rest of the film.
I think certainly Soderbergh is behind the commentary track, and I think he kind of sees all the different things that we're talking about. You know, he certainly has experimented in different ways to present it. I'm glad that he does take the time to do it, because I've certainly enjoyed him. Mm-hmm. Another one that's really interesting, I don't know if you had a chance to listen to it, was Stallone's Rocky Balboa commentary.
When they run up to the top of those steps and they get there and they raise their arms, it's like, I'm ready to dream. I'm ready to believe that I can do incredible things in my life. By me coming up here and looking down at the city, there's no reason I shouldn't go out there and give it my best. So I say to all of them and everyone here, Just keep punching. Just keep punching. You never know. You never know. You may just hit your dream right on the jaw. This was the final image. I didn't know people were actually shooting this. This was a moment when I realized it's over. As soon as I finish the scene and say cut, I can't come back here anymore. Rocky's on his own.
I think certainly the perspective of the whole series, I guess he's recording at a time where he felt very good and comfortable about the film and so forth. Yeah, I found it quite inspiring.
Well,
and to be a good listen.
That's definitely a series of films that I would like to see Stallone comment on all of them. I mean, I'm waiting and hoping for my eventual ultimate edition of the Rocky films, you know, all six of them in one package type of a deal, but covered well, you know, covered like the Batman films were, you know, with commentaries and documentaries and et cetera, et cetera. Give me all that stuff, and especially the Stallone commentaries, and that would make me really happy because I want to get in there. I want to find out what happened, you know, in Rocky V, what happened with Rocky IV when he's, you know, doing these giant, you know, long montage scenes.
Montages, yeah.
You know, I want to see what he's thinking, and absolutely, and I'm definitely going to jump all over that Stallone.
Well, when Blade Runner comes out later this year, you'll finally get the Ridley Scott commentary for that.
Right.
We know that will be there. And he's been very good about putting commentary tracks on most of his films.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're a Ridley Scott fan, they're usually always pretty engaging tracks.
Definitely.
Tony's been good about commentaries as well.
I love his Man on Fire commentary.
Oh, yeah.
Really gets in there and talks about, you know, all the techniques that he does.
And also in terms of stylistically, I use a lot of the techniques that I use throughout the rest of the movie in terms of different cameras. We used, you know, like 1910 hand crank camera, what we call reversal stock, which is, I think, to the layman, it's what I call heightened reality. It strengthens the blues in the skies, the blacks, the whites, the colors. And then we did that on a hand crank camera, and then we put it through a process called cross process in the laboratory, which gives an even more heightened reality, stranger, reaches more contrast and more vivid color. We were scouting locations one night in Neza, and I was priding myself that I was in the toughest barrio in Latin America when no police would go. And I was going, and it was 11 o'clock at night, and it's such an extraordinary location, I thought it's worth the risk. And yeah, sure enough, we've got 10 kids around us with no shirts on and on crystal meth, and there's 20 kids, and then there's 30 kids, and we've got one bodyguard, and there's five of us, and then all of a sudden there's a Teamsters parking lot nearby, and there's like the old guys. We looked like good pickings because we had cameras and watches, and then these older guys, like in their 40s and 50s, started coming out, and then a bodyguard pulled his gun, and that was the sort of beginning of the end. It was like a sequence out of City of God. Suddenly there's 12 guns. Yeah, and then it became a little hairy or a little scary or however you want to put it. But our bodyguard pulled his gun, and that was a mistake because all of a sudden there's all these other guns and everybody screaming and yelling, and then a squad car came out of nowhere. This one cop jumped out asking our bodyguard for his gun. It was a true Mexican standoff. And in the middle of all of that, they jumped him, grabbed him, they pistol-whipped him. They broke his nose, knocked all his teeth out, and there was blood everywhere, and they beat the living daylights out of the cop as well. The cop crawled his car and drove off. In the middle of all this mayhem, we escaped up onto an overhead walkway. We were right inside the movie. Only an hour before this thing went down, I was saying to them how great it was and how great everything was going and everything was cool and it wasn't dangerous, and then this happened. So I was really close to getting the movie pulled. Anyhow, they said I was forbidden ever to go near Neza. It was called Ever Again. I suppose it wasn't too smart going in there, but you felt like the whole time we were making the movie, we were, the crew and the actors were inside the movie. I tried to get inside Denzel's head. The kidnapping I think the feel of the sequence, I always wanted to make it not like a normal shootout. I think right now it feels like part documentary, part grabbed real footage, and part opera. And the opera comes from being inside Denzel's head, so I wanted to see this from Denzel's point of view and feel it from Denzel's point of view. So here I used a mixture of different camera techniques in terms of what we talked about earlier, hand crank cameras and different stocks sped up, you know, shooting it at 100 frames a second on certain pieces and or shooting at 6 frames a second on other pieces, yeah. And it's just a case of it's a gamble. It's like, what's so great, though? I think I have enough experience now to have an understanding of film, so when I'm doing things, I can anticipate what I need. Or when I look through the camera, I'll say, okay, this we should be doing on this stock or that stock. It's like painting pictures. I'm now able to have an instinct about what film stocks I should be using, like what paint I should be putting on a particular piece of the canvas.
I mean, absolutely love all that stuff because he's really getting into the dirt of what he's doing with his experimenting. So
I was really glad that Susan Sarandon contributed to the hunger.
What hooked me to the character was this question of, if you could live forever, but it meant that you would be an addicted person, what is the trade-off? And somebody who chooses not to live forever under those circumstances, I thought was a really interesting choice. But then they changed it, so it was no longer about that. But and I just thought, you know, I admired both Bowie and Deneuve, and I just thought, wow, you know, how great to work with both of them. And I thought, if it doesn't work, it'll be an interesting failure, which I'd much rather be part of than a film that kind of compromises and is derivative of films that you've seen.
This was my first movie that I made back in 1983. And this script came to me through MGM, through Dick Shepard, who used to be the president of MGM. And he actually consulted with Alan Parker before he'd give me the gig, because he wasn't sure I could do it. He'd seen my commercial reel. He'd seen a film for television that I'd done. But I think that's what really sold him was the stylistic quality of what I'd done in commercials.
I mean, I guess moving into this portion of the show, mm-hmm. everyone had been listening to us babble about commentary tracks. Do you have some that are your favorite?
Oh, definitely. I mean, you know, and a lot of times it kind of falls into the line of, you know, well, this is one of my favorite films, so, you know, it has an equally great commentary type of a situation. You know, I had mentioned Batman and Robin, you know, and the whole idea of, you know, films that aren't so great. And hearing that, Ferris Bueller also was, you know, that Lost commentary. Anything Star Wars is going to be good for me. Although, you know, I really would like to have heard more Lucas than, you know, it was really, the Star Wars commentaries are really, you know, chopped up interviews more than they are commentary tracks.
Right.
Placed all together. So that's kind of a letdown, but, you know, any kind of Star Wars stuff is good. I can tell you that... That, of course, the Star Trek films, you know, as most of you guys know, I'm a Star Trek geek. Star Trek II, Wrath of Khan in particular.
Oh, yeah, Nicholas Meyer's very good.
I cannot claim to have been an undiluted fan. First of all, I didn't know the television series very well, but I could never quite relate to it. I related to this when I suddenly began to think of it as the adventures of Captain Horatio Hornblower in outer space. Once I got that, I thought, okay, so this is about the Navy. This is about gunboat diplomacy. And I grew up loving those books, and so I redesigned the uniforms, or caused them to be redesigned, and I made them more militaristic. And whether you call it the Navy or whether you call it the Coast Guard, which have more or less characterized all the shoot-offs and spin-offs of series since, I think of myself when asked to put down my occupation on passports and applications, storyteller, not filmmaker, storyteller. It never really mattered to me what venue the story was going to be in, play, novel, movie, television script, science fiction, comedy, tragedy, historical, pastoral. I didn't care. There was a movie that I very badly wanted to make in the wake of Time After Time, and nobody was interested in letting me make this movie, so I was sort of pouting. And my friend Karen Moore said, you know, if you want to learn how to be a director, you should direct and not just sit up here like a spoil sport. And she said, because she worked at Paramount, and she said, there's a guy there named Harv Bennett who's been assigned to make the next Star Trek movie, to produce it. I think you'd get along with him. Why don't you go talk to him? And what Star Trek always meant to me, and I thought most people, was Spock's pointy ear. So I started the movie with Spock's pointy ear. The Star Trek fans are a very vocal group, and when word got out that Spock was going to die in this movie, there were all kinds of reactions, negative, I might add, you know, and threatening letters, if Spock dies, you die, and so forth. And I said, well, maybe we can diffuse all these expectations. I said, let's put the simulator scene at the beginning, which is a fun way to start the movie anyway. Let's kill him off at the beginning, and then everybody will forget about it. Now, I was up at ILM, actually, discussing the shots when Harv Bennett called me and said, we have a real problem. Bill doesn't like the script. Anyway, I went back, and I had a meeting with him. When I finally thought over what he was actually saying, it was something that I was able to fix in 24 hours. And I turned the thing around and sent it back to him. And I came back to my answering machine 12 hours after that. And there was this ecstatic message, which I have saved for all time. I just took the tape out. And whenever he gave me stick on the set, I would play him this thing. You're a genius. I don't know how you did this, blah, 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 blah. And I'd play it back at him and say, Bill, genius. What I noticed with Bill was that the more takes you did, the better he got. And the reason was that it was always very leading man-ish at the beginning. And if you did it long enough with him, he would get bored. And when he got bored, he just started being instead of acting. And that got better. Yeah. Chekhov is in this scene, although he was not in the Khan episode. He was not in the series at that time, but I stuck him in. I mean, I could just have easily have switched it around, and Chekhov could have been on board the Enterprise, and Uhura could have been in this scene, and it would have been technically correct. I never wasted any thought about it. By the way, if you read the Sherlock Holmes stories, which I'm very familiar with, Conan Doyle made all sorts of mistakes in the Sherlock Holmes stories. Sometimes Watson refers to his wound as being in his arm, other times in his leg. Mrs. Hudson is the landlady, but one time she's Mrs. Turner. And Doyle himself was quite cavalier about it, and he said, I have never much striven for it, meaning accuracy of detail, and no doubt have made some serious blunders in consequence. What matter, so long as I hold my readers? And I guess that's the Chekhov defense.
Nicholas Meyer's fantastic. You know, I love hearing Nimoy, when he started directing, do those commentaries. But, you know, I'm guilty there because I'm a Trek geek. But just having those, you know, and I was the sucker who bought all the Star Trek movies and then bought them all over again to get those special editions. But, you know, one of the strong things about those discs was getting those commentaries. So... Right. So those are definitely very nice. Run, Lola, Run, Tom Tykwer, you know, what can I say? You know, you got to hear. I mean, that's one of those ones where I watched the film and was so freaked out by it and blown away that I immediately listened to the commentary track right afterwards. I did the same thing with Spike Lee's Bamboozled. You know, I was really moved by that movie, and so I just immediately jumped right to the commentary and listened to the whole thing.
I did the same thing when I saw Bamboozled. I just wanted to hear what Spike had to say about what I just saw.
Exactly.
I included the definition of satire because I wanted there to be no mistake what this film is about. And despite that, sometimes it didn't even work with some of these critics. And this is
I'm one of those people responsible for
my signature shot right here
on your idiot box.
Damon Wayans is riding on a dolly with the camera, and we're going all around his apartment. And the fact that it was shot on video looked like it was keyed in like it's blue screen, but it's really not. This film was shot on mini DV. This film was shot, for the most part, on digital tape. We shot with the Sony VX-1000, which is a consumer camera. It was we had a very small budget, and in order to shoot all our pages and also get the necessary coverage, we had to go this way. These cameras are so small, enabled us to shoot multiple cameras. We wanted a look that wasn't film, but wasn't necessarily video. That's why we chose mini DV. High definition, high def, beta, too clear, too crisp. That's why we chose to shoot with the mini DV camera.
And anytime you have that and you're that interested, I think that's fantastic. And the commentary tracks really satisfied as well.
Yeah, the Fight Clubs were like that too, and there was just so many to go through. But having a Fincher solo and Fincher with the actors was really great in terms of covering a lot of different aspects of the film.
Oh, yeah.
The Panic Room set had a commentary with the writer David Koepp, and it had a special guest, which turned out to be William Goldman.
That's cool.
Can I start?
Please fire away.
The morning before this idea existed, do you remember the moment that happened when you thought, there's a movie about a panic room? In other words, is this an old idea of yours?
Well, it was. I'd read an article in the New York Times about safe rooms, they're actually called. And the script was initially titled The Safe Room. And then I thought, safe doesn't exactly convey danger, so I changed it to Panic Room. I read an article about them, and I tore it out and threw it in a story ideas envelope I keep and thought maybe someday there's a movie in that. The other thing I wanted to do was have no dialogue, try something very short. I was really interested in all the economies, you know, right then. I think it was the end of the year, and all the end of the year movies that are very, very long were coming out, and I was getting more and more outraged in movie theaters, you know. And I wanted to do something like those great 40s thrillers like Sorry, Wrong Number, you know, the things that took about 83 minutes and were just incredibly taut.
I'm going to interrupt you. I hate movies now. They're so long.
Yeah.
And I was brought up on movies that, you know, 83 minutes, 95 minutes, something like that. And they're just, because I think directors think length equals weight.
Yeah.
And they think, oh, it's an important movie. It's 2 hours and 50 minutes and you want to scream. And, well, it's a terrific job of directing, I think. It really is.
It's gorgeous. And the performances are very good. There's a lovely moment here with the Coke that was David's idea where Jody's character has stopped her daughter from having more Coke, and then she said, when her daughter says something saucy about her ex-husband who she doesn't like very much, she gives her more, which I just thought was very true to that painful time in this family. But when Jody came in, helplessness is just not something she conveys, you know.
Can I interrupt?
Yeah, go ahead.
I worked with her on Maverick, and I believe, of all the stars I've ever worked with, she's so academically sound. Most stars are not academically skillful.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean?
Well, I think she was honors at Yale.
Oh, yeah.
That's what I mean. I mean, yeah. Most, you know, Tom Cruise, did Tom Cruise have any college? Did any of these guys mostly... Don't. Most movie stars are performers when they're 8 years old. Russell Crowe was performing when he was 2.
Yeah.
So they don't have an academic background for the most part, which is fine. It doesn't matter. But Foster has an intelligence that I never met in any other performer.
She's very, very smart.
She
came in, I think, on a Friday, and we had to start on Monday, imagine. And so I remember we had dinner, she and David and I, on Saturday, and she was pointing out all the things that were going to be kind of inconsistent with who she plays, particularly in the first 30 pages, because the first 30 pages are really set up the character, and then the rest is reacting to the situation. But she pointed out all these inconsistencies, and I was sinking lower and lower in my chair. And then very calmly, she started suggesting simple ways that things could change to – you know, to fit who she wanted to play. And they were great ideas. And I started sitting back up in my chair and just taking notes because she was so smart about it. And they were so surgically precise. You know, the changes were very small, but were really important.
Who was great because he didn't have anything to do with the movie. He's just a screenwriter.
Right.
Basically, he kept it engaging for David Koepp. So the two of them as screenwriters can just talk about screenwriting while doing a Panic Room commentary. So if you're interested in that, it's certainly a unique idea to have two screenwriters just going on about. Goldman has contributed a few commentaries. His Princess Bride one is certainly unique because of his relation to the material.
Anytime there's any kind of special thing, it's always interesting for me to at least to hear it once, you know, and hopefully it's good. But then think about something like this. When the new editions came out of Willy Wonka and we had the Wonka kids doing their commentary, which I thought was great. Not the Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. I'm talking about the classic film.
Right.
And so now we get the grown-up kids, you know, relating what had happened to them. I mean, that's a great hook, you know, to do something like that and just look on there and say, okay, well, yeah, we could get the director, but, you know, that's kind of fun. It's special, and it's a lot of times just like a real one-time listen, basically.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's going to be certain, again, different schools of thought. Mm-hmm. I think certainly having many years perspective away from a film,
sure,
you're going to bring a lot to the table, probably.
Oh, no,
hopefully.
Now hold on. There's another one that we just I just thought of is the redo track. Okay, the anniversary track. How about this? When you have a director do a commentary track, and then they put out those 25th edition or anniversary edition, and he'll do another one for that. Remember Gary Marshall did that on The Pretty Woman.
Oh, God.
And it's like, the original wasn't good enough.
I know the William Friedkin one for the Exorcist, The Virgin You've Never Seen.
Ooh.
That commentary is pretty tired compared to the other one.
Right.
Because that was, he already had done a commentary for Exorcist. Right. He did it for the first DVD release.
Right.
So here he was to come back and do it again. I mean, what's he going to talk about? He covered it.
Well, and that's just where they're trying to spice up. That's DVD ripoff. They're saying an all-new commentary.
Right.
You know, and I'm like, well, what's wrong with the old one? You know, it's not out of print. I mean, it's just they're defaulting up to the next thing, and the other one wasn't good enough. We have to offer an all-new commentary.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's silly.
Now, worth mentioning is a website out there I found while doing a little research. Mm. It's called WriteThatCommentary.com.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a whole website dedicated to commentary tracks.
And we'll put a link to it on the podcast page.
They have a section where, you know, different people can add titles and give ratings to various commentary tracks.
Mm-hmm.
They have a list of the 50 worst and 100 of the top commentary tracks.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just going to read off some of the ones that different people out there have been rating very high.
Sure.
In terms of commentaries. Number one was the 7 Laserdisc commentary from Criterion.
Wow.
Too bad you can't get your hands on it, but it's the top commentary track out there.
Wow, so that's sad.
Exactly. That's right.
Yojimbo. Nice. Brazil came in at number 3. Sin City was ranked pretty high. Evil Dead 2 was ranked high. Aliens from that Quadrilogy set.
Absolutely.
Was number 8. Platoon came in at number 9.
Mm.
Roger Ebert's Citizen Kane was number 10.
Mm.
Videodrome, commentary with James Woods and Deborah Harry, ranked kind of high as well.
Huh, that's strange. No.
But Dead Ringers ranked right after that with Cronenberg and Jeremy Irons.
Huh.
Straw Dogs ranked kind of high, too. With Stephen Prince, author of Savage Cinema.
Huh.
Let's see. Apocalypse Now is up there. Serenity is in here. El Mariachi. Halloween, which was a Criterion exclusive track with Carpenter and the late Deborah Hill and Jamie Lee Curtis.
Uh-huh.
The Spinal Tap. The Alien, the solo commentary track with Ridley Scott. Vanilla Sky with Cameron Crowe and his wife, Nancy Wilson. Clerks 2. I guess that opens up the whole Kevin Smith commentary track section, which we shouldn't neglect because his commentary tracks can often be a lot of fun.
Sure.
Because they're a group celebration of all the people involved.
Right.
And I remember another funny one was Trey Parker and Matt Stone got really drunk and did the commentary for Cannibal the Musical. So it's a strange and interesting listen. Christine with Carpenter and Keith Gordon.
Hmm.
There's a RoboCop with Paul Verhoeven. The Conversation, again with Francis Ford Coppola.
Nice.
Boogie Nights. Now, Paul Thomas Anderson did a commentary, but did a second one where we went around and interviewed a lot of the different cast members and asked them a bunch of questions and then edited it all in.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, nice to see Tideland, the Terry Gilliam. The Evil Dead commentary ranks high. 12 Monkeys, Godfather Part 2, Manhunter, The Limey, All the President's Men with Robert Redford, Terminator 2, Bull Durham with Kevin Costner and Tim Robbins, Used Cars, which has Robert Zemeckis, Bob Gale, and Kurt Russell.
Nice.
JFK, a very engaging track from Oliver Stone, who I will say, as someone who come in and does their commentaries, you can often hear papers rustling. Because he wants to make sure that he's getting across the points, right, accurately, quoting the right things and the right names.
I really like Stone's commentaries. He has a very soothing voice, you know, and he's rather quiet, and he covers everything.
Because he's stoned.
Well, I guess by now you know that most of the people who went to Vietnam in the infantry were mostly from the lower economic classes and mostly draftees. Very few middle class kids went, or upper class, because they were basically shielded by a crazy set of laws that provided if you went to college or had a psychiatric deferment, you could get out of the war. So as a result, it never really became a democratic war in that sense. It was more of a class war, and the pressure to end it did not come from the parents of those middle class people who could have gone, because it would have, if they had gone and started to die in any great number, I believe that their parents would have ended that war much faster. So in the 1st Cavalry, much later in my tour, actually, I got a chance to, through King and some black friends, I got into the Yahoochas down below. So they had these crazy bunkers up in the 1st Cavalry where guys would really design them, and lights and neon, sort of underground nightclubs, and we'd smoke great dope, great Vietnamese dope, pipes and all kinds of ways, very inventive. And this was a relaxant and a great stimulant and an alternative lifestyle to a very dull and angry day style, you know, where a lot of people were drinking and partying. But here we had a chance to bond with other people and to talk about dreams and keep sane, in a way, keep sane, keep human. It was important to keep human there because the place would deaden you after a while. And I'm very grateful to these soldiers. They introduced me to music. That's where I started to hear a lot of black jazz, a lot of Motown and The Doors, Jefferson Airplane.
Yeah, it feels good.
I discovered Jim Morrison there.
Yeah, and I really love, because he's stoned, I really love the Any Given Sunday commentary quite a bit.
The way the NFL tells us we have to see it. I mean, what has happened is what Jim Brown says in the movie is a one-hour game, which is very fast and tough. I mean, when I was a kid, we played, and in school, we played both ways, offense and defense. It was a 60-minute game with four official timeouts. Now, with television having bought the game, essentially, for a vast amount of money, television money is the dominant money, you have a situation where you have to have official timeouts so that they can cut to commercials. This is disastrous. It kills, as Jim Brown was saying, that, you know, it would destroy the... The whole concept of football is in synergy, a sync between the players. They move down the field together. That's when the offense is clicking. You're in the groove. And then suddenly get to the 18-yard line. You're about to score a touchdown. And then they call an official timeout because they got to go to commercials. Kills the momentum. Kills it. I've seen it time and again happen out on the field where the team has to sit around and wait for 3 minutes or whatever, come back in, and it's gone. They'll kick a field goal, but they'll never get that touchdown that they should have had. So right then and there, you have an artificial situation.
But that's one of my favorites as well. So
yeah. The Alexander theatrical cut, it was Oliver Stone and the historian Robert Lane Fox, who's one of the noted Alexander experts. And it was very interesting.
Now, one I picked up recently, which I really appreciate, having the different, you know, because there's a lot of commentary tracks on it, is what Mel Gibson did with The Passion of the Christ, is that, you know, you get his commentary as a director, but then you also get, like, you know, top religious leaders. You get, like, a group of Catholic priests talking about the film, and Mel's in there with them, and they're bouncing off all these ideas. And,
well, that's a great idea.
Well, and it's great because it you know, you get a historical angle, you know, you get Mel's angle. It gives you a lot of stuff. And I think that's, you know, it's really strong food for thought, you know, and it's not like it's some sort of a worship session or anything, but it's just them going through and saying, okay, biblically, this is what really happened, biblically. And they talk about how, you know, Mel was a stickler for all that kind of stuff. And I think that just having that available, I mean, it was obvious when the film first came out and it was kind of a bare bones that they were going to dig into this more with a bigger set. And they definitely, you know, it's a good one.
Well, one of the interesting things the Matrix box set did that I think is also kind of unprecedented is there's two types of commentaries, none from the Wachowskis.
Wow.
Commentary one is sort of a philosophy content with people who are pro in favor of the film.
Uh-huh.
The second commentary track is three critics who are not in favor of the films.
It might be useful to recall at this point, going into number two, the absolute pent-up excitement that had been building over the course of more than 4 years for part two, because Matrix 1 had been such a phenomenon. And then, of course, the real, you can't just describe it as a cult. I mean, it was a huge, one of the hugest cults that I've remembered seeing in the cinema. And the anticipation was such before the second film that it was guaranteed everything to be one of the biggest openings ever in the history of cinema.
No, and the film also had the commercial advantage of that. It had the psychological disadvantage of the audience of creating a sense of anticipation that probably no film could live up to.
In the mind of a teenage audience, 4 years is a very long time.
You could actually, I think, feel at this point already the air was starting to leave the
theater.
Just
beginning to go out of the balloon.
And people were thinking, oh, no.
But still, you had to hold out.
You had to hold out because you thought, oh, maybe, you know, they spent some time in this boring place last time.
Mm.
And here, no, here's like the beer commercial thing.
Right, you know, the slow-mo.
Yes, the slow-mo urban beer commercial for, you know, for white audiences to show that they're down with people of color. It's also deeply boring, I think.
Deeply?
It's one of the things I remember. This was, I think, the point in that same screening that I mentioned, where Todd and I were, where you could just feel the audience and just you know, like, get on with the movie.
Yeah, well, where is this film going? It's so much of a departure from the first film.
Yeah.
Huh, interesting.
So they literally gave complete audio space for three critics to rag on the films as much as they wanted.
Oh, see, I need to hear those then.
And
I want to hear the rag
session. I thought
that
was a very brave way to handle both sides of the coin.
I want to hear the rag sessions for The Matrix.
Now, I do know the Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas film that Terry Gilliam made did have a Hunter S. Thompson commentary track, which will make that very unique in a historical perspective.
Now, do you have any of the worst on that list?
Well, number one currently is 2019 After the Fall of New York.
What the hell? Yeah, we need
it. It's got a 0.0 rating.
See, that makes me want to listen to it now.
The Exorcist, the version you've never seen.
Really?
Appropriately.
How strange.
Rollerball with LL Cool J.
All right.
Rush Hour, Brett Ratner.
Great.
Ultraviolet, Mila Jovovich.
Oh.
Rush Hour 2, Brett Ratner. Family Man, Brett Ratner. X-Men 3, Brett Ratner. Spaceballs, Mel Brooks. Ed TV.
Oh.
Bowling for Columbine, which says it's receptionist, production assistants, and interns.
Oh, yeah, pass.
Blazing Saddles, Mel Brooks.
Man, Mel's not doing the good commentaries.
What Lies Beneath, Star Trek Nemesis, director Stuart Baird.
Oh, see, now they're just hitting on the movie there. They're not even...
The Santa Claus 2, The Mrs. Claus.
No one even listened to these commentaries. You know they didn't.
Kingpin got a low rating.
Yeah.
U.S. Marshal, Stuart Baird. Species 2, director Peter Medic. The World Is Not Enough. K-Pax. Star Trek 5. Cliffhanger, your boy Rennie Harlan. Charlie's
boy.
Angels, your boy McGee.
My boy, Mick McGee.
And let's see, what else is on here? The Patriot. Cliffhanger, Pretty Woman. There's your Gary Marshall. So, I don't know. Anything else, you know, go over to ratethecommentary.com. You can rate them. You can pick whatever the worst one is, you know. You're right. The Jerry Maguire probably should be in there somewhere.
It's terrible.
Although, I should probably finish the commentary before I say it's not very good.
It's almost impossible to finish because you don't want to just see them watching this movie. You know, hey, I want to watch people watch a movie. Boy, that's great. That's, you know, one step away from, you know, that movie where they film people sleeping. The Warhol movie, you know.
Think about commentaries I'll never get. Some Hal Ashby commentaries would have been great.
Yeah.
You know, I would have loved to have a Bud Cort and Ruth Gordon over Harold and Maude. That might have been nice. Some George Roy Hill commentaries might have been nice.
Mm.
before he passed away. That's a sad thing. It's a new thing, and certainly for all the films that are going on now will be preserved. But where's my Kevin Reynolds, Kevin Costner, Fandango commentary?
Yeah, that's for sure.
I'll double dip for that.
Sure. Well, where's my, you know, please, James Cameron, go back and do a commentary for everything, for The Abyss, you know?
Yeah, well, I guess he thinks the documentary covers that. And he did do commentary for the deleted scenes mm-hmm. of Terminator.
Right.
But not for the film.
Yes. Yeah,
interestingly enough.
I'm really excited about that Graduate commentary coming out. Because,
yeah, I think that's going to be,
you know,
like,
Graduate's
really good.
Graduate's one of the greatest movies of all time. And just to hear Nichols talk on the film is just going to be absolutely fantastic.
And you're going to get a Dustin Hoffman and Catherine Ross commentary.
Oh,
which is that's icing on the cake.
That's fantastic.
Exactly. That's right.
Yeah.
But sometimes, you know, your wishes don't come true. I remember when I saw that Robert De Niro was on, I think it was either like Meet the Parents commentary.
Yeah.
I was like, ooh, De Niro, cool. Can't wait to hear it. You put it on, crickets.
Yeah.
I think it's a group commentary, but, you know, he just doesn't have a lot to say, actually. He says it in the movies, so
yeah.
That's fine.
Yeah.
You know, not everybody has to be an engaging commentary speaker,
right,
for sure.
Right. Well, and, you know, there's one other type of commentary that I want to talk about before we shut it all down. It's very important.
Beyond the Brett Ratner commentary.
No, not the Brett Ratner commentary. It's probably worse than the Brett Ratner commentary, and that's the...
The Yui Bowl?
Almost. It's the Hollywood Saloon commentary.
Oh, well, now you're getting somewhere. This is in the top 100 worst commentaries of all time.
Well, and you know, if we're going to talk about this, we got to put our money where our mouth is. And, you know, and I think that's one thing that we're interested in, we're excited and trying, but I can tell you it's not as easy as it appears to turn a film on and to go 90 minutes or 2 hours, you know, without, because, you know, we know what makes for a bad commentary track. And so anytime there's a breath, we're like, what am I going to say? It's not like, you know, we're going to do a double take on these things, too.
Well, and it's also, I found, you know, when we were recording our commentary tracks, falling into the same traps
mm-hmm.
of being screened, just talking about what's on the screen while I'm trying to think about sure. the next anecdote that I want to talk about.
Right.
Or listening to you say something and then forgetting what I was going to say. Things of that kind of nature. So,
right.
you know, it's certainly, it is an art form. And I think it's one that probably the edited commentaries are ones that are really designed and well prepped.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Have the best chance of coming off really well and even being something you might listen to more than once. I mean,
right.
I think you certainly want to bring us, you know, amount of research about the making of the film and interesting anecdotes and stories. But at the same time, you know, we're giving a comment to give our thoughts on it,
well,
right?
Well, and that's the real deal with us. Not being the makers of the film, if anything, we're the guest/historian type of... We're adding in within those genres type of commentary, and really, there's no way to not be self-indulgent on these things because we weren't there. You know, we're not talking about, you know, the making of the film. We're talking about what we read about the making of the film, or we saw about making of the film. And if a film already has a commentary track, how can we compete with the director? So really, in the end, you know, it has to be that you're interested in hearing what the Hollywood Saloon has to say about this particular film. That's all we can really offer to a certain extent. If I'm doing a commentary for a Star Wars film, speak anything more than what George Lucas or his crew could offer. So really, it comes down to that kind of deal. And I think that's true for commentary tracks across the board, is that it depends on how you sit down. Because, you know, a lot of people, if they're not really prepped and they don't have those notebook and those pages and they don't have a lot of points to add, they'll sit down and really they're giving you their opinion. If you want to listen to a historian talk about Total Recall, that's one thing. But when you want to hear Arnold, you want to hear Arnold's perspective.
That's right. Exactly.
He's not going to bring you the ins and the outs of the inner workings of the film. He's going to say, yeah, this is where I tore his arms off.
Oh, that's funny.
Or whatever. Now that we've given it a shot, Really, like I said, there's no way not to be self-indulgent. You'll hear our opinions and that kind of thing within those commentaries, and I think that's pretty across the board for anyone who tries to get in there and do it, especially if you just say, roll tape, and you're off to the races.
Also, look at it this way. Is it really anything different than just doing a show on, say, Blade Runner? I don't see the commentary is really that much different than a podcast. You and I, if we decided, hey, we're going to do a show in celebration of Blade Runner, okay? We would get all our sound effects together. We would get all our music cues together, right? And we would sit down and we would talk about Blade Runner for an hour and a half or 2 hours, okay? And that would be a Blade Runner show. Mm-hmm. Well, hell, we might as well just hit play on a DVD player and do a screen-specific commentary. And that way we can talk about everything we would talk about in a Blade Runner show,
right?
And at the same time, comment on the film and certain things that we like, and hopefully tie it all into an interesting listening package. To where my philosophy is, the best commentary tracks, you shouldn't need to watch the film with them. Mm-hmm. You should be able to put them on either when you're driving or in a room, you know, cleaning or typing or sitting on the toilet, whatever. You know, a good commentary track should not require the film's viewing to be listenable and to be good. Mm. But if you are watching the film and listening to it and it's enhanced by that experience, then all the better.
Yeah, sure. I agree with that. I think that and it really depends on the kind of tact and structure they're bringing to that commentary. Now, obviously, if we record a show, we have a structure in front of us. We've done our research. We can stop time and add in our sound effects and our music, et cetera, and really sweeten it up. But when you do a commentary track, like, you know, we're not going to go any further than just saying record play, and maybe we'll take out a cough or something like that.
It's pretty much, it's a live
show. Yeah, it's a live show, and that's why it's easier. They're pretty easy for us to do because we just sync it up and boom, we're there.
Well, they're easy to record. They're not easy to do.
Well, that's what I meant to say.
I don't know. I found when we started the process, I was all excited.
I think it's really a balancing act between screen specific and big long stories about your feelings of the film and that sort of thing. I think in the end, anything is bound to be self-indulgent to a certain extent. If you're listening to anyone other than the artist, it's a whole different genre in a ballpark. And so when people like us, freaking amateurs, step up to the plate and do a commentary, I think it's nice that, you know, we have the technology to do that and to push that onto our audience. But you really can't sell anything more than here's my reflection of this work.
If they don't like it, it's really easy to turn off. No sure. Lost, you know, value there.
So basically that's it, what we're talking about for the commentary shows. But what we said earlier was we put our money where our mouth is and we went out and we did some commentary tracks for ourselves. And we thought it would be fun when we released this show to give you some Hollywood Saloon commentary tracks for some specific films. Now, we don't have the final list yet of exactly what we're doing, so we'll let that be a surprise. We'll probably make it available in a couple places. We'll make it available on the podcast page on the Hollywood Saloon, www.hollywoodsaloon.com. You click on podcast on the left side of the page. You can also go to the special edition page, and we'll have a whole new commentary section down there. We just want to make sure you don't miss it.
You got to come to the website, though.
You have to come to the website.
No more of this just freeloading off of iTunes, okay?
If you want to dig into the main show, obviously, you got it on iTunes, but these extras, it will be no less than commentaries that we're releasing.
We're talking plus hours of Saloon.
Right.
So anyone out there that's saying, oh, are they ever going to do another show? There's plus hours right here in this one page.
Right.
Go get it.
Right. And so that's what we'll do. No less than, maybe even more, we'll release the same day as this commentary show, just as a gift to you guys, to you listeners, and for us diving into these commentaries. And we're not able to really judge how they are. We'll see what you guys think. I know that we had a good time doing them. And continue to do them, and it's something that we might continue to do in the future. We have plans of doing, you know, tons of them. We'll see where it goes, and if that's something that's popular with you guys. And really, what it is if you have the disc, you know, you put your disc in, and we have a sync point, and we say 1, 2, 3, go, and there it is, and you'll be synced up, and you can watch the film. And it doesn't have to be, you know, specifically synced the whole perfect.
And you don't, like we said earlier, if you just hit play and you're in your car and you got a 2-hour drive, well, we're going to talk about for 2 hours. And
right.
If you know the film, you probably don't even need it playing to listen to the commentary.
Right, and it depends on how you want to listen to it. Treat it any way you want to. It's yours once it leaves our page. So there you go, The Art of Commentary and the bonus tracks from the Hollywood Saloon. So we hope you dug that today. And, man, a lot of work on this.
Do you have any commentary on the commentary show?
Yeah, listen, we're going to do, after this, we're going to do a commentary show on this commentary show. It'll be a second track you can download, and you'll be able to sync up the first show with the second show. Yeah, not.
So commentary tracks, they're here to stay, right?
Absolutely. They're going to get bigger. They're going to hopefully continue to get better.
You need to get more of these commentaries, more of these actors out there and directors that made these films. And we need to preserve their thoughts and comments on it, because we wouldn't think twice about doing it in an interview format or in a documentary format. So I think the commentary is a natural progression of those ideas. Yeah. But it's one that I think has a chance of giving the film not only a longer life, of having, you know, more to offer for that film 10, 20 years down the road, when really all of this will be forgotten.
Okay, well, that's about it. I've told you probably a lot more than you ever wanted to know about the Hollywood Saloon. I hope you've enjoyed this commentary. Thanks.
For some reason, I just needed to see what made the new disc so tricked out. I ended up living on the street, giving hand jobs for public domain movies on DVD. But I picked myself up. I got my life back together. Now I only give hand jobs for Criterion DVDs. Do you understand what I'm saying?
That if I give enough hand jobs, I can get Fast and the Furious on DVD.
You're listening to the Hollywood Soul.
That's right. Exactly.